Okay, we're going to call the Senate Finance meeting to order today. It's Wednesday, February 19th. The time is 9:07. With us is Co-Chairman Kelly, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, and Vice Chairman Senator Fairclough. So we have the full committee. And today we're going to continue our discussions on capital appropriations from the various departments. It looks like we've had a little change in the lineup, and I apologize if this messes up any of your schedules out there. But we're going to start with Commerce, and then Administration, and then Resources, and then finish up with Labor and Workforce Development. So is there anything to come before the committee before we get started? Seeing none, then why don't we go ahead and have the folks with Commerce join us at the table. And, okay. We have Ms. Goad and Ms. Hanahan. So further, I don't know who's presenting in what order, but so I'll just turn the floor over to you, and if you'll just put your name on the record, we'll get started.
Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity to present to the committee. I'm Joellen Hanahan, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And with me is Sarah Fisher Goad, Executive Director of Alaska Energy Authority. We'll start with the Community Block Grants, which is reference number 38946. It's for $6,060,000. This is an ongoing program, a federally funded program that provides grants to communities and nonprofits to provide services and benefits that benefit the low to moderate income individuals. There's two programs under this project. There's the Community Services Block Grant, which is a pass-through grant to RuralCAP. And there is the Community Development Block Grant, which are grants to municipalities for planning, infrastructure, and economic development that benefits low to moderate income individuals. Moving on to economic development, reference number 54070. And I apologize, our books are in a little bit different order, so. This project is for $400,000. This is a continuation of a former capital project that was given to the department a couple of years ago when we were asked to expand our activities to focus on a larger picture in relation to economic development. These funds have allowed the department to expand our core marketing activities and to promote the Alaska brand in the marketplace. That's allowed us to do things that we just weren't capable of doing before. This includes we've provided some the Icelandair. We've worked with Icelandair on providing service to Alaska. Icelandair opens us up to about 20 destinations in Europe. So we're doing a marketing program in those to garner support from those 20 areas. We have had the Top Chef program here filming that exposes us to 2.5 million viewers. We have an Arctic initiative where we're working with the University of Alaska on the commercial activity, on what our shippers needs, what would be some twinning ports between Alaska and other countries. We've engaged with other countries, Norwegian Embassy and other countries on identifying some of those elements. We have also been able to respond quickly in a way which the department was not able to before. For example, with the issue of the branding of Alaska's fish and Walmart not wanting to sell the fish, we were able to respond immediately. We were able to go quickly to Walmart headquarters, start negotiations. We did this in engagement with the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, and ultimately Walmart has agreed to sell our fish. We also were able to participate in a U.S. Manufacturing Summit that was sponsored by the National Retailers Federation and by Walmart, looking at U.S.-made products. They're very interested in Alaska-made products, and we've had, as a result of that, one of our Alaska vendors has been able to enter into the national level with their product. One of the other primary things we're involved with is a Made in Alaska home. This is the supporting the actual construction with home source materials within Alaska. In this, we are partnering with Peterson Group of Anchorage and the Cove Climate Housing to develop this region-specific home with Alaska materials and to support manufacturing and building. So these are some of the initiatives, not all of the initiatives. We also have been able to participate in mineral shows that the largest mineral show in the world, that's 30,000 investors and interested parties show up. We did a special opportunity Alaska there and have had follow-up from some of the attendees there. We're working with DNR on research and implementing a marketing campaign for timber products in key markets, and we're promoting Alaska's industries and products at some key trade shows. So these are some of the activities that the funds have allowed us to do and that we will be able to continue with this $400,000. Moving on to 55631, Nutritional Alaskan Foods. This is a grant to allow Alaska produce to be for school districts to serve Alaska grown foods. It's grants to school districts throughout the state. Sarah?
Is there any questions before we change speakers here? Okay, seeing none. Senator Fairclough, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering on the capital budget side why we have 52507. It's page 18 as far as on our overview, and it says energy plan implementation, $500,000. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, for the record, Sarah Fisher Goad, Alaska Energy Authority. That is the reason I'm up at the table is to talk about the next several projects, including the energy plan implementation. We can get to that one if you want me to go down the list. And Mr. Chairman, I would be starting with 56220, which is the Susitna-Wetana Hydroelectric Project, $10 million.
Okay, let's see. We're trying to keep up with you here. So, what page is that? Or are the pages the same? Probably not.
Mr. Chairman, the order that I have these projects is the 56220 is the next one in line after the nutritional Alaskan Foods for Schools.
Got it. It's page 7. Okay, very okay. Good. Oh. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chairman, the Susitna-Wetana project, this is the $10 million request for FY15. There is a supplemental that is also, I believe, going to be discussed tomorrow with OMB presenting a supplemental information, a request of $32.7 million that will allow us to continue with ours. Second study season, which is now being split between the field seasons of 2014 and 2015. So specifically this $10 million request allows us to continue with our environmental work in order to prepare to file for a FERC license application, which would now be targeted to be filed in 2016. The language, there is a contingent language with respect to continuing on with making sure that we receive the necessary access permits, working with the Cook Inlet region working group, the regional corporation of Siri and the village corporations from Cook Inlet. We have made significant progress with working with them on this access permit and continue to work through those issues. We have commitment from them to make sure that we are able to receive the access that we need for this year, and we continue those negotiations and have again made very good progress with respect to to work on that. With the remaining funds that we have in FY14, with the supplemental and then with the FY15 request, we are able to prioritize our field work. Instead of doing all of it in this one field season, we will be able to do this work into the two field seasons in order to prepare for this license application. The additional funds do provide us some ability and some flexibility to do some of the more expensive studies this coming year, and also provide certainty to a lot of the contractors that have been working with us from last field season to this upcoming field season. And I know we discussed this project last year. I guess I, if there are questions at this point, or I can continue on with our other capital requests.
Let's go. Just quick question. What you hope to get to an open season when?
Mr. Chairman, for our project, the goal is really to complete all the necessary work to file for a license application in 2016, and that would be with the FERC regulatory agency, with the expectation that we'll be able to receive a license in 2018.
Okay. Thank you. Additional questions? Nina, go ahead.
The next project, Mr. Chairman, is page 8, reference number 49734, which is our bulk fuel upgrades request. And, Mr. Chairman, this has been a longstanding capital project request that the Alaska Energy Authority has had. Early in the years, we were funded significantly with the Denali Commission. We continue to work down on a priority list to provide code-compliant bulk fuel tank farms in rural Alaska. This project in particular will provide us funds to construct the Kipnik tank farm and the Cake tank farm. Although federal funds have declined through the last few years, we do continue to receive Denali Commission funds, especially for the bulk fuel tank farms. The next project, Mr. Chairman, is page 10. The 57255, the renewable energy projects round 7. This request, Mr. Chairman, is for $20 million to go down the priority list that we presented the detailed information to the committee last week.
Senator Faircloth has a question.
Mr. Chairman, I was still back on the bulk fuel tanks and just had a quick question there. Are we, when we are looking at what we're doing in the community, evaluating what we're doing with the Renewable Energy Fund, too? Because I thought CAKE had a project for renewable, and so I'm wondering if we need, are we designing the bulk fuel plants then to take into account that we're displacing the fuel?
Through the Chair, Senator Faircloth, yes, we've been taking a very, very much a community approach with respect to these projects. In particular, the tank farm, the consideration of the needed fuel is considered as we move forward with that. And then with the RPSU projects, what we're really looking for with the development of those projects is in communities that have a wind resource that we're able to very, very much connect those two projects, or waste heat, for example, from a powerhouse. So there's a little bit more of a connection with their powerhouses than with the tank farms, but we are looking at very much a holistic approach for communities, and CAKE's actually a very good example. We've had, not only are we working with CAKE on the bulk fuel tank farm, we do have a powerhouse that we are evaluating. They are looking at biomass as a potential also. So we've had a lot of our subject matter experts be involved with the community of CAKE and working on their energy needs. So, Mr. Chairman, the renewable energy project, since we did cover that last week, if there are any questions, I can move on to the next project, unless there are questions.
Yeah, I think we spent plenty of time with that last time.
The next project, Mr. Chairman, is page 12, project number 52498, which is our rural power system upgrades. And as I just mentioned before, too, with respect to RPSU projects, this is another longstanding rural energy infrastructure project that the Alaska Energy Authority has been funded to provide the right-sized powerhouses for rural Alaska communities. As mentioned before, we do coordinate with our with our renewable program to make sure that the projects are able to be integrated with any renewable resource that is available in a community. This project will fund the Nunamiqua project and the CAKE project for the powerhouse. Mr. Chairman, the next project is the page 14, 55450, which is a specific distribution project for the community of Quingilingoc, and then the next one, I'll cover both of these at the same time, page 15, 55445, which is a distribution project for Tentatuliac. A couple years ago, we received an AEA-managed grant or appropriation to lead the effort to develop these distribution projects for these two communities. We were not involved with any type of a cost estimate. The community had been really promoting, or the utilities and the Chenin and Gwynn group had been promoting the development and the need for these distribution projects. When we were provided the appropriation and started to do the initial work on these projects, working with the utilities and with the Chenin and Gwynn group, we did an evaluation of the original cost estimate and had determined that there was insufficient funds to be able to manage the scope of both of these projects to the extent that the community wanted to move forward with them. So these additional funds provide the additional dollars in order to complete the distribution projects as originally envisioned by the rural utilities. As you can see on the funding history in Session Law 2012, there was $2.168 million made available for Quingilingoc and $1.832 million available for Tentatuliac. So again, these additional dollars will supplement those original appropriations in order to complete these distribution projects. The next project, Mr. Chairman, is page 16, 32950. This is the Electrical Emergencies Program. For many years, the Alaska Energy Authority has provided electrical emergency response to rural communities, and what we have been able to do is to provide the technical support when a utility has either lost power or it's imminent that power will be lost. For example, they may be down to one generator and the other two are not working. We're able to dispatch folks out to the communities to make an assessment of the situation, oftentimes providing the equipment and the technical support at the time in order to make sure that the power can be restored, and making sure that there is no loss of any of the critical infrastructure in the communities.
Very good. Senator Bishop has a question.
Sarah, thank you. What's your react time to an event? Let's say the Royal Manly Hot Springs called in and their generators are down, and the state has assets there with public schools and DOT facilities. How fast could you respond to a situation like that?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we actually can respond quite quickly, and we do work with a lot of our technical experts that understand the diesel systems have close relationships with the powerhouse operators in the communities. So either we're called directly at times from them, or emergency services will call us. And so we do have a process in place where they're able to react quite quickly and get on essentially the next plane if they need to get out to the community, or we can dispatch someone that may be a little bit closer. And so we have an opportunity to do it as quickly as we can, of course, weather permitting. It depends on certain circumstances, but we try to respond as quickly as we can.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, the last project for the Alaska Energy Authority is page 18, 52507, which is the Energy Plan Implementation. And I know Senator Faircloth had a question about this. This has been a project that we've received funds in the past. On the funding history, you can see that we have received some additional funds. We did not receive an appropriation last year to essentially complete these regional energy plans. The goal of these projects is to really take The regions that weren't covered by the AEA-led projects of the Railbelt Integrated Resources Plan and the Southeast Integrated Resource Plan work with the other energy regions to make sure that we develop plans that are appropriate for those regions. The funds in particular for that are listed out here are planned to essentially complete the projects and what we've called the phase three activities, which includes the technical and economic analysis of potential projects and look at financing options. And so these plans are really designed at a regional approach to help prioritize potential projects, not necessarily saying that the state of Alaska would be in a position to pay for them, but we could provide the analysis and the support to help find out what type of financing options, including loans or other options that are available for projects to be completed. And with that, Mr. Chairman.
Oh. What, Senator Fairclough?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many regional plans have been completed to date, then?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, we have several plans that are in a phase two draft situation, and none of the plans have been completed. None of them have been funded to complete through this phase three approach on the analysis of the projects.
Mr. Chairman, just pointing out that we've invested $4 million, and I'm just wondering how, and we started doing that in 2010. It's 2014, and so I'm wondering how long does it take to complete a plan then? I know that we absolutely want to reach into individual regions and communities and take the time to walk together so that we understand what's happening there, but do we know how long it's going to take to complete what we've already started? Where are we in the queue? How many's in the queue? How many are we working on?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, we actually have six regions that are under contract with AEA to work through the plans. We have been working with the regional ARDRs, the economic development organizations in the regions, to really lead that effort. The stakeholder approach and working with the multitude of stakeholders in many of these regions does take a bit of time to work through these issues. I think we've been working with the Chulista region the longest, and it's also one of the more diverse region with a lot of many small communities in the region. So we do see that there is an ending in sight with respect to the investment that we've made in these plans. But also at the same time, one of the things that we wanted to make sure that we addressed that honestly was not, I think, considered when we first went down this path of these regional plans is to really look at how propane and LNG and other types of fuel sources can be utilized in the rural areas when we first had not considered them. And this is something that through the state energy or the interior energy project, looking at advancing that type of fuel or other fuel sources in the regions, we really want to make sure that we incorporate that. And again, it's not about deploying renewables, it's really looking at affordable energy throughout the state. And I know there's desire to make sure that we are evaluating what coal could be utilized on a local basis or including peat in other areas. So we are looking at the variety of fuel sources with respect to the projects that can be prioritized on a regional level.
Mr. Chairman, six regional plans for $4 million. So I'm just wondering how much more it will take to complete the six that we're on, and are we bringing new regions in, or are we limited at six? How much additional investment will we need to complete the project?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, I think the anticipation is that the only additional funds that would be needed would be the $500,000 for FY15, and we did have slated a potential for $500,000 for FY16. And again, I think that we did not receive any funding in FY14, and so we continue to move on with the plans without FY14 funding, with the anticipation that FY15 would have been the last year that we would be looking for funding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Senator Berkowitz. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I strongly support this appropriation. Energy costs in rural Alaska are the number one problem, the number one concern of people that are living out there, because energy costs consume more than 50% of their energy needs. And just the Chulista region is the size of the state of Washington. And I believe these dollars are well spent to give focus to the to these regions. 4 years might seem like a long time, but in retrospect, I think it's the regions need the time to get it right, and if they do get it right, in the long run, I think it's going to save the state of Alaska millions and millions of dollars.
Okay. Senator Bishop?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sarah, this front-end money here for these projects, regionally, when you're done evaluating them, are they project ready to bid in or pretty close to that?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, our goal is really to have projects prioritized by the region, and then also for us to provide the analysis of that. A lot of the projects that will be evaluated are projects that are also already in the queue with other programs, either the Renewable Energy Fund program or our Rural Energy Infrastructure program. And so we want to make sure that we incorporate all of that into the region, and then make sure that the region is helping to prioritize which projects are next.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sarah, as you go back to page 7, which has to do with the Susitna Dam, I see that you're proposing that this year you've got $10 million, and then next year is going to be $217 million, and then $100 million after that? Am I reading it correct?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, there's actually been an amendment with respect to the backup that's been provided to the project. What we have done is focus our efforts on the licensing and not the engineering. At one point, we thought we would be doing a lot more detailed design and engineering on the project at the same time that we're moving forward with the licensing. We've determined that it makes more sense to focus on the licensing aspect and making sure that we have the ability for a project before we go into the detailed design. So the adjustment that we've made in the backup for the amended request is really focusing on beyond the $10 million for FY15, and then I had mentioned there's a supplemental request for FY14. What we had anticipated is an FY16 needing an additional $73.1 million to get us to license. What we have referenced, instead of having it as a potential request in for the licensing effort, we did put some additional engineering cost estimates into the detail of the backup, which would be roughly $245 million. But again, the purpose of the licensing portion of it is really to focus in on that aspect of the FERC process to make sure that we have a project before we expend any of the engineering funds.
I guess I'm a little confused. In 2016, you said you're going to need another $73.1 million on top of the $216 million?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I apologize. It was actually reduced from the $245 isn't part of that backup. And again, there's an amended backup detail request with the $10 million that reflects only 73.1 in FY16, not the $245 million that you had seen before.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Okay. Sir, continue. Or are you done?
Mr. Chairman, unless there's any more questions for AEAM, I've completed my presentation.
Any additional questions pertaining to AEA? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, I'm Joellen Hanrahan, Deputy Commissioner of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. I would like to bring to the table also with me our new Administrative Services Director, Ms. Jeannie Mungo, and we'll be tag-teaming it through the rest of these projects.
Sure. Okay.
Okay. So the next project is on page 20, Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority, Ambler Mining District Access for $8.5 million. This is to gain all-season access for exploration and development of mineral resources within the Ambler Mining District. This is about a $330 million project. These funds that are being asked for now will help to complete the feasibility analysis and the environmental impact statement. And looking forward to a future public-private partnership for the construction part of the project. The project itself will result in about 300 jobs over 4 years, $120 million in payroll, and with the open access, it's estimated that revenues to the state will have the potential of $331 million. The next project is on page 23, the Alaska Railroad Positive Train Control. I do understand that the committee, I think, has already had a presentation on this. It's for $15 million. And it's positive train control is a technology designed to stop a train before human error or causes an accident or a derailment. No further questions. We'll move on to page 24, Fairbanks North Star Borough heating device, air quality, reference number 58442.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Jeannie Mungle for the record, Admin Services Director for the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. The next item on our list is the Fairbanks North Star Borough Heating Device Air Quality Mitigation. That's page 24. And essentially, the request of 58442 is for $2 million, and it's essentially to provide funding to North Star Borough, Fairbanks North Star Borough, for the heating device changeout programs. It will allow the borough to assist residents with programs to remove, replace, and repair their solid fuel heating devices with cleaner burning devices. Next item on the list is page 25. It's item number 55603. It's the Kotzebue Swan Lake Small Boat Harbor. This request is for $2.5 million. It's phase two of the Swan Lake Small Boat Harbor build out. Phase one essentially has been completed. This phase will allow the city to expand the use of Swan Lake to meet this need by providing adequate mooring, docking, and storage facilities for the winter months. It's very much a needed project, as the Shore Avenue erosion project eliminated the use of the existing boat harbor for many of the subsistence users. Item page number 27, 57375, Matt Sue Borough Bogard Road Extension East. This request is for $5 million. This project provides an additional east-west corridor from Palmer to Wasilla to reduce traffic congestion. This funding will provide the final link for the Bogard-Selden corridor. The project will provide the remaining funds needed to complete the construction of 3.25 miles of road between Glen Highway and Palmer and Trunk Road, one of the borough's few north-south arterials.
If I may, is this the final phase of that project? And is this, how did this fall in commerce versus DOT?
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, these projects, a lot of smaller road projects go through the department because they're not within the STIP plan for the Department of Transportation. So many small projects, both on legislative named grants and municipality grants, end up going through the department.
Okay. And then is this the last phase? I'm sorry, I missed that part.
Yes, Chair Meyer. This project will provide the remaining funds to complete the 3.25 miles of road.
Excellent. Thank you. Oh, Senator Denlin?
Through the chair, is there coordination with the other departments? For example, if there's going to be a water line laid down along this route, is there a discussion between the departments to make sure that that's kind of brought together or not an add-on later on?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that's an item that I would have to follow up with you on.
I think I can answer that. Okay. Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, yes. We have local government specialists that work throughout the state, and they're really cognizant of what's happening in the community and help coordinating between departments. There's a lot of back and forth between DEC and DOT and the department on projects. So, yes.
Thank you.
Okay, next item is item number 57374. This is the Matanuska-Susitna Borough Rail Extension to Port McKenzie. This is a $5 million request. This is providing funding for construction of a rail extension from the Alaska Railroad mainline to Port McKenzie, a deep water port. This request is for continued development and construction of the Matsu Borough Port McKenzie Rail Extension Project. The extension is expected to stimulate development of new mineral mines, development of limestone deposits, new opportunities for timber exports, and they expect 4,000 jobs will be created along the rail line.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt you. Is this the final cost on that rail line?
I'm not sure.
And is anybody else participating in offsetting some of the costs?
Chair Meyer, the information that I have available to me is that it appears that there is additional funding that will be needed. To what degree, I don't have that information at this time.
Okay, what about the second part? Has anybody else participated in the funding? Metsu Borough, perhaps, or
Chair Meyer, I'll have to get back to you on that.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Next item is item number 52278, the Whittier Shotgun Cove Road. And I apologize as I flip through my book. This request is 52278. It's in the amount of $2 million. This project extends Shotgun Cove Road 2.5 miles from Emerald Cove Trailhead to Trinity Point. It's a paved 24-foot road that will improve the quality of life and produce much-needed revenue sources for the city of Whittier. The project will allow access to currently inaccessible federal, state, and municipal and Native corporation lands. Next item, 45816, Alaska Air Carriers Association, Medallion Foundation, page 31. This is a $250,000 request for the Alaska Air Carriers Association. This is essentially to, the foundation provides access to aviation training devices, as well as a multitude of other flight simulator training and advocacy courses for commercial and private aviation stakeholders. Medallion Foundation participants transport 90.3% of the passengers in Alaska. Participants in the safety program serve 100% of the communities in Alaska.
Not Oscarville.
You're on next. Okay, item number 58698, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, Alaska Rural Utilities Collaborative Expansion. This request is for $500,000, and it's essentially to provide, it supports Alaska Rural Utility Collaborative community retrofit needs. Since 2008, Alaska Rural Utility Collaborative has been working to operate and manage community water and sewer systems. It benefits the community with lower fuel and parts costs, improved water quality, and steady employment of local water operators. In fiscal year 2014, $1.7 million was appropriated to bring new communities into the collaborative. Okay. Page number 34, item number 38713 is Arctic Power, Arctic Energy Issues. This request is for $250,000. Again, it's reference number 38713. This project will support education efforts to open the coastal plain of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for oil and gas exploration and development. The purpose is to provide funding to aid in the opening of the coastal plain of ANWR.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Senator Hoffman?
I know everybody at this table and everybody in Alaska supports this project, but has the administration looked at how effective this program is, and what are the prospects, and what has the department done in the last 2 years with the $550,000 to accomplish their goals?
Senator Hoffman, this has been a longstanding legislative appropriation that is, in efforts of opening our ANWR to Arctic to oil exploration, and we will get back with you on standing on where it's at.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, no, I think Senator Hoffman, I share your concern. This has been an appropriation ever since I've been here, and obviously it hasn't gotten us the results we wanted. I think it would be good to see what we're getting for that $250,000. How many people they have hired and flyers are sending out, whatever they're doing. Senator Olson and Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment on it. It's my understanding that Arctic Power now is becoming involved with the OCS reallocation of the resources that are out there. And obviously, the original results of opening up ANWR were less than effective. But now they've started down this new path to try and make it, because we have an opportune time with the Senator being, and Baucus has been named to the be the ambassador to China, so he's going to be replaced by the Louisiana senator. I don't remember her name right now, and so I think that's the avenue that they're going down.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, if they're branching off in OCS and other areas, then we should change the backup, because the backup says ANWR, which...
I don't think they're stopping ANWR, just at the present moment. I don't think the political flavor there in Washington, D.C. is favorable toward us.
Senator Fairclough?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe that there are two employees. One of them was here last week, and there's one and an administrative assistant. As far as value goes, I accompanied a delegation 2 years ago, and we, for the first time ever in Alaska's history, passed a resolution. I believe it was in the House of Representatives in support of ANWR opening. So they did make some headway, but $250,000 compared to actually moving the needle is a small amount of money as far as what we're investing in actually accomplishing something. So I agree that we should review it to see what's going on. But they provide value in the sense that they're keeping that conversation going on every piece of legislation that comes up that they try to insert the language back onto. And our delegation is using them as a resource to get into offices and talk to people. But one person is not going to make this happen.
Okay. Can continue, please?
I'll take the next.
Okay.
Okay. The next item is on page 35, and it's reference number 41959, Arctic Winter Games State Team Alaska State Participation Grant in the amount of $485,000. This will assist the Arctic Winter Games Committee with ensuring that 350 athletes and coaches are able to travel to Greenland in 2016.
Page 36, reference number 55062, Blood Bank of Alaska Facilities and Services Expansion Project. This is for $7 million. This is to continue construction of a new facility to consolidate separate facilities within Anchorage. Page 38, Inter-Island.
Hold on just a second. Same question. Is this it? We're trying to finish projects, and I know we've been contributing to the blood bank, so will this be the last contribution we'll be making to this facility, or is there more in the future, and who else is helping on this?
Mr. Chairman, we'll get back to you with that information. It appears that the project cost is about $50 million, and I am not sure where all the funds are coming from for this project, so we'll get back to you on that.
Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not fully funded, and in expression of support of the blood bank, they are entering onto a capital campaign program and have done so for the past year. I'm not sure how much money they've actually collected towards the match, but I think it's probably incumbent upon us to tell them it's the last contribution if that's the way the committee wants to go forward.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I would hope, you know, obviously the hospitals benefit from this as well as other groups. I just hate the state being the sole provider, so if you could maybe let us know what other methods they're pursuing to get additional funding.
Mr. Chairman, I do see that they are doing some private fundraising, but I don't have the detail on that, so I'll get that detail for you.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Meyer, I actually have additional detail to provide.
Okay.
The total project cost is $51.5 million. Funding that's already been secured is $29,760,000. They've received state grants. They've raised private funds to date in the amount of $610,000. And the sale of their existing building and Blood Bank of Alaska cash is in the amount of $3 million. That's the level of detail that I have currently.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
The next project is page 38. This is for the Inter-Island Ferry Authority for $500,000. This provides daily service to between Ketchikan and Prince of Wales Island. Passenger revenue and other funds are insufficient to cover the projected costs. This is Transport Link is a vital service to Southeast Alaska. The next project is page 39. This is the Marine Exchange Alaska Vessel Tracking Project. The request is for $600,000. This is a vessel tracking system. It's required for commercial vessels over 65 feet and that are in vessel traffic system zones. In Alaska, we have about 30,000 miles of coastline covered. We have over 100 receivers that go from Kaktovik down to Ketchikan. The system is paid for by the users, both industry, federal agencies, and state agencies. Cruise ships are pay a fee for this. GCI pays to help our fiber optic cables be monitored. Lloyd's of London contributes to this project. Federal agencies, the Coast Guard, the National Park Service, NOAA, and FAA are all partners in this. The state agencies have over 100 access accounts into this system. It's used by DEC for cruise ship monitoring, wastewater discharge monitoring and spill response. Fishing game monitors commercial shell fish and determining what areas are okay to fish in. They look for concentration of fishing vessels. There's also, in some cases, places where they used to have to put observers on skiffs where they can now sit at their desk and have access to the system. Emergency services uses the system for determining which vessels, which ports might be impacted by storms and for logistics support. DNR is using the system related to Arctic development. Transportation has over 40 accounts and tracks all the ferry traffic through this system. Public safety uses the system, and commerce also uses it for marine pilot service investigations. The cost of this system runs about $3 million a year. 75% of that is operating, 25% is capital. There's a constant rollover. When there's huge storms, pieces of this equipment need to be replaced and repaired, and that's part of the capital piece, and also building out expansion and technology to give us a a further offshore a view of what is occurring. The state's contribution to this is about 20%. The last project is page 41, reference number 38948, National Petroleum Reserve. This is an annual appropriation that provides grants to communities for public facilities and services that are in the National Petroleum Reserve. This request is for $2.8 million, and there normally around this time of year is an amendment that solidifies what this amount will be and what communities they will be going forward with, and that process is in process right now. And that concludes our testimony.
Okay, thank you very much. Additional final questions? Seeing none, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And I think Department of Administration, you have a PowerPoint, so we'll take a brief at ease while you get set up. Senate Finance back to order. We have now with this Department of Administration, and presenting is Commissioner Thayer. The floor is yours, sir.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Commissioner on the Department of Administration. And with me is Sherry Lowenstein, who is the Director of Admin Services. And this morning we have a PowerPoint because a lot of our capital requests are bricks and mortar, so we'd like to show you what we're doing and how the money is being spent. The first one is reference number 58322, and that is for $1.2 million, and it is for Enterprise Technologies for a UPS or uninterrupted power supply replacement for the data center. We recently, in May, had an issue with power outage here in Juneau. We had problems with our generators, and it went to UPS, and we had a hard shutdown of our mainframe computer, which lasted for 7 days before we could bring it back up, and one of the causes was we had very outdated UPSs, and we'd like to get more robust uninterrupted power supply to that mainframe. On page 3, reference 58240, It's to replace outdated informational technology and infrastructure. And with DMV, we have outdated servers and storage devices. And this will, we've also had issues with being, having the system up all the time, and this will help it be uninterrupted and will ensure that Alaskans have access to DMV resources at home, traveling, or deployed overseas as we bring more online DMV systems online. And then this also interfaces with online voter registration and driving records. So it's that interface. Under reference 58168, it's the motor vehicle real-time driving records. The legislature in a past appropriation approved for a new IT system to replace our current Alvin system. It's about a $10 million project. The piece that was not included at that time was to allow for real driving records, which has been a request of the insurance industry as well as DMV in regarding providing information where you will go to get a quote for driver's insurance, but they're using outdated information. And this would allow us, as we, long as we do this integration right now, we're going through this process, we can add this functionality to the program so it accesses real-time driving records. Reference 49602. Page 7 and page 8, this is one appropriation for a total of $10,250,000, which includes for building maintenance of our public building fund and our non-public building funds. Let me flip to the next one. We own various buildings throughout the state, anywhere from the Atwood building to the parking garage adjacent to it, the Fairbanks State Office Building, the State Office Building here in Juneau, the Diamond Courthouse, the Community Building, as well as the Governor's Mansion, third floor of the Capitol. And so what this will allow us to do is continue our projects. We prioritize them for critical life safety projects first, followed by replacement of key building systems such as boilers, waste lines, roofs, and other items. And with this next slide, this is one of our past deferred maintenance projects. What you see in the upper is the Atwood lot before. This is the lot adjacent to that. We had to tear up the complete plaza. The envelope, it's a roof of the parking garage. It was leaking. It had not been replaced in over 30 years. We were getting 4 inches of standing water down below in the basement. And so that was completely replaced and waterproofed and hopefully is good for another 30 years. And then the completed project afterwards is the public square that was created above the parking garage. Example here in Juneau is the sidewalk in the upper one, and then it was non-ADA compliant, and it was inadequate landings and deteriorating concrete, and below is what some of the maintenance money was used on, was to repair and replace part of that stairway. Deferred maintenance with reference 54183, and this regards the ETS and our state communications deferred maintenance. This is year 5 of 5 for $3 million, and it is to continually upgrade. Matter of fact, the Parks Highway this past summer, we were able to increase the bandwidth twofold. And we use this for tower inspections, cable tensioning, installing microwave systems in the various shelters along the way. The following one is we've also worked to increase fuel capacity and reduce refueling missions because with these sats, this is outside Sadovia on Independent Ridge, we've increased the fueling capacity, so we had to have fewer helicopters come in and do fuel deliveries in the wintertime. The following slide actually is outside Cordova. That behind there, which looks very nice, is actually one of our sites completely covered in rim ice. And for that site, one of the deferred maintenances that we had was to increase the guide and cabling, including reinforcements to the tower, in order to withstand the weight of extreme ice, such as in this case here. One thing that we would always like to touch on, and that is space standards. One thing that we have done as a department and for statewide perspective is look at improving our use of our space. We currently own, I say we, the Department of Administration, 1.6 million square feet. We lease another about 3.5 million square feet. The slide above was taken in 1970 in the State Office Building, and the slide at the bottom is newly renovated space standards for the Division of General Services. When we started this project, we anticipated a savings of about $125 million over the next 20 years in reduced lease costs. We anticipate that now to be closer to $140 million as we've gotten into the project. And the savings is after we do any type of construction or using the replacement furniture. This is not something that the Department of Administration money it saves. It's saving money for departments that reduce their footprint. We've done this through a WSCA contract, or Western States Contracting Authority. We've created these neighborhoods to increase better airflow, fewer walls. We've eliminated more private offices and moved the employees to the windows and the private offices to the interior, and then not redistributed, but also have a new fewer private offices is ideally what we'd like. Obviously, you would have it for your directors, you would have it for medical personnel, attorneys, HR personnel, but for the most part, we're going with the open concept for all the employees. One thing that I will bring up, two things, and as is the part of this universal space standards, I think a good example is what recently happened in the Atwood building. We had a department in commerce who had misordered some stuff, or some stuff was misordered when they went to universal space standards. We're doing universal space standards in the Department of Administration. We just swap stuff out. We have the same look, the same color, the same styles. It's universal, so there was no waste whatsoever. We took what they did, what they ordered extras of, and what they didn't order enough of, we ordered for them and was able to do a swap. And so that's what the purpose of universal space standards is not everybody is using different brands, different colors, different styles. And one thing, too, is there's not capital money being used in space standards. It's with agency that have funds. We've also worked with the bond bank. They'll finance these at for 10 years at 3% interest, so it's something that agencies can build into an operating budget if they need to, plus whatever reduced savings they get by going into space centers is a reduced operating cost for them, and that's another way that they're able to help pay for it. And then with lease buildings that we're in, it's something that can be amortized over the cost of the lease also. Again, we're getting smaller footprint in our lease buildings, and so that's where part of that cost savings comes in. And one thing with space centers, it's going to take probably a good 5 to 10 years to fully implement, because we're looking at buildings or spaces that are doing major renovations, where they're moving, where there's new leases that are needed to be done, and we do an analysis on the space. And usually what we're determining is if there's a 5 to 7 year payback to the state, then it is worth doing. We have one agency in the Atwood building that if they were to fully implement space standards, which we are working with them on, there's an approximate savings of over $1 million a year just in their operating budget, just for that one facility here at the Atwood building. Another case in point of something that we have done is this is the parking garage here in Anchorage. We had on the first floor, we had 15,000 square feet that was not being utilized that needed to be built out. We're in the process of building that space out. And with that, we're moving Child Support Services and the Permanent Fund Dividend Corporation into that space. That should be done this fall. It will be done this summer. And we're able to do that for a cost of square footage of $1.56 when downtown rates are going for as high as $3.50 a square foot. So we're doing it for less than half that price. And then also with this is this customer service friendly in the sense that we already have DMV located in the same location. There's a bank at one end, so people could park in the parking garage and do state business and never have to cross the street into the Atwood building. And what that allows us to do in the Atwood building is to build out space for a new agency to come in, a more expensive lease to come into the Atwood building. And since these are high traffic departments, DMV is already on the first floor, but it also reduces some of the traffic in the Atwood building, which of course in the long run, especially for elevator maintenance, is an ongoing cost. three buildings here that the state legislature has fully funded, and I wanted to give you a status update. One is the state office building here in Nome. We started funding was secured last year. We started construction in January. We hope to have construction completed in April 2015. The above picture is what it currently looks like. We have six agencies in that building. We hope to have eight agencies. Two new agencies will be added into that building. In addition to, with the use of space standards, they have two conference rooms they did not have before. There's a cafe for the employees they did not have before, as well as an ADA public restroom. And the project budget's $11.6 million, and we just started, but we are projecting with the contractors to be not only on time, but on budget for that project. The second building is the Douglas Island Building update. We received complete funding from the legislature as of July 2013. We're currently out on bid in that prospect of that building. Construction is to start in April of this year. We hope to have the construction complete in August of 2015. There were two agencies in that building before, Fish and Game and Department of Corrections. And with space standards, we'll be adding one new agency with about 25 new employees. And with that, they also have two cafes. They've received three new conference rooms, one being 500 square feet, so they can have large public meetings there. Parking has always been an issue at this building, and so we have worked with the City and Borough of Juneau to lease additional space nearby with the harbor, and so we'll have additional parking not only for the employees that currently reside in that building, but also for any new agencies that we move in. That project's $18.2 million. Both Nome and Douglas Island will have new space standards. They are a complete gut and remodel of the building, and it makes sense to go in with space standards for those two facilities.
Curtis, we have a question.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, did you calculate in then the cost of your new lease space or your new lease parking as far as your recovery rate?
Yes.
For the renovations, and it still pencils out that we're doing better at leasing parking?
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, yes, we did. We're increasing their $40. I don't exactly have the exact cost, but it's pretty nominal working with the city because they use that primarily parking in the evenings and weekends. We'll use it during the day, and so the price was very reasonable as opposed to a commercial lease. One thing, too, that we're seeing in actually all three of these buildings, including the next one, is with these buildings completely being gutted and remodeled and new heating systems, new windows, new insulation, we're anticipating a lower operating cost for these buildings, too. So all those factors are factored into this.
Thank you.
This, I think, if anything, is a kind of a crown jewel of government working at its best. The Sam's Club in Northeast Anchorage was going to be vacated by Walmart when they had built their new building into Cottonwood Commons. It was identified by the department by an employee driving by. In October, about October of 2012, we had done an estimate on the building. The governor had put it in the capital budget last year. The legislature approved the capital budget, which included $15 million. The GMC was originally going to be a $45 million new build. That's what the state was putting a little bit of money towards every year. We found this building, and then we worked and negotiated with Walmart, who donated $2.5 million to the purchase price of this building. Now they did not own it, but they had the lease on it. And quite frank, they're good business people. They also saw the state owning this facility was a $100,000 warehouse that wouldn't compete with them. So they had an incentive to work with us, but with the $15 million purchase price, or with the $15 million from the state, previous appropriations, and the Walmart donation, we have a project budget of $24.5 million. We've purchased the building. Walmart moved out in October. We have done an RFP. We're right now into a construction phase of increasing the slab so it can take additional weight for core samples as well as new shelving. And the building will be open in September 2014. So literally, from start to finish in 2 years, this is a savings of over $20 million to the state by identifying a warehouse in Anchorage that would exist, would meet our needs, and actually allow for growth going forward. And really, I thank the Finance Committee for helping us last year secure the funding so quickly, so we could purchase the building. And with that, that concludes my presentation. I just thought it'd be better if you saw what we were doing as far as reading numbers off a page.
Very good presentation, Commissioner Thayer. Appreciate that. Also, too, I know you have a new DNV director. I see her in the audience, Amy Erickson, and want to congratulate her and welcome her to back to the state legislature. Anything else for the commissioner? Good job. Thank you very much. Okay, let's move on then to resources. Chair of the Labor and Commerce. Okay, it looks like the group is here. I don't know who's leading the charge. You are. Okay, if you could put your name on the record and proceed, please.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jean Davis. I'm the Director of the Support Services Division for the Department of Natural Resources. We're here today to talk about our FY15 capital budget request. I have Deputy Commissioner Ed Fogles and Deputy Commissioner Bob Swenson, which will be, they will be speaking to the majority of the projects. I'd just like to start with saying it's a $28.2 million budget request, of which $15.8 million is general fund. That's about 22% less than we ended up with in our current FY14 capital budget. Our projects were developed really to support our core services and are focused on the responsible resource development and on our efficiencies in permitting, resource assessment, deferred maintenance, and providing access to state land and safe access as well. And with that, we will start with our first project, and we do have them by reference number and page number. Hopefully they follow along on your book.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ed Fogles, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. I'll start with the first project on page one, the impact permit project and document management, reference number 38872. This is the continuation of the department's initiative to automate our permitting systems. As you all know, we manage a very immense portfolio of natural resources, and over the last few years, we've been trying really hard to improve the way we do our business process. We've been trying to eliminate a backlog. We've gotten some good resources from the governor and the legislature to help us. We're also doing statutory and regulatory reform, but I think a big part of this is automating our business process.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Swenson, the Deputy Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources, for the record. And I'll be referencing reference number 58256 on page 5, Yukon River Crossing Fault Characterization. The Yukon River Crossing is a critical point for infrastructure and land link along the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, Dalton Highway, as well as an area for the proposed natural gas pipelines. In the fall of 2012, there was a major slope failure, landslide, on the southern, near the abutment, 400 yards to the west of the current bridge abutment, that identified some significant faulting in the bedrock in that region. We worked with the DOT as well as with Alyeska to identify the subsurface drilled core wells in that area. One of the biggest issues in that region, there are three very large through-going faults across Alaska, the most famous, of course, being the Denali Fault System. But to the south of Denali is the Castle Mountain Fault System. And in this region, we have the Tintina and Caltag Fault Systems that are active faults. One of the issues we have there with new LIDAR information, that's high-resolution elevation information, as well as new carbon dating techniques and trenching to go into current surface ruptures and identify the activity, both the recurrence rate as well as the last movement on any of these faults, to help us understand what the hazards associated with those faults will be in this critical infrastructure area. And now for reference number 51052 on page 8, Strategic and Critical Minerals Project. This is the third year of a five-year project to assess and determine the potential for on-state lands for hosting strategic and critical minerals. We both fly high-resolution airborne geophysics in those regions, as well as do detailed mapping and modern techniques on resampling both archive samples at the GMC and the USGS, as well as new samples collected during the field work. Now to move on to office space renovation in the new Geologic Materials Center to accommodate the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office, reference number 58307 on page 14. The State Pipeline Coordinator's Office currently resides in leased space in downtown Anchorage. Their leases are coming up, as well as the federal portion of the pipeline office has moved to federal buildings. But this appropriation for $2.165 million would be for is to build out 1,800 square feet of new office space at the space standards for the state within the Geologic Materials Center. And DOA has calculated that this would be a savings just in the cost of leases of $900,000 over 10 years and $3.1 over 20 years. And it would also reduce significantly the current cost of leases, which that cost being passed on to our current leaseholders on our pipelines.
Okay, the next project is on page 16. It's the Lower Kenai River Park Facility and Access Improvements Project, reference number 57971. We purchased, using Exxon Valdez oil spill monies, a piece of land on the Lower Kenai, a very heavily used area, and we will be using this money to design a dock and build a dock and a launch and parking and new restroom facilities, providing access to a very critical part of a very heavily used state park system. The next project, King Cove Road, Eisenbeck Right-of-Way Permitting, reference number 58594 on page 18. This is $100,000 of general fund that would be used to fund either one of two eventualities. If we are successful in getting Secretary Sally Jewell of the Department of Interior to reconsider her decision to deny the community of King Cove access on 12 miles of road to the Cold Bay Airport. If we can't convince her to reconsider that decision, then we will have to prepare for legal challenges for that decision, because that's we stand firmly behind that project. If she does reconsider, then we will need to jump on this project and initiate permitting for the 12 mile section of road.
Senator Bishop, I think, go ahead and ask your question, but I think we're going to wait until the end of your presentation, just because I know, I forgot we have bells at 10:45 today. Are you okay with holding off till we're done? Okay, thanks, Senator Bishop.
Okay, the next project is Forest Access Mapping Inventory and Reforestation Projects, reference number 58258, it's page 21. It's for $900,000 of timber receipts. Essentially four projects. One would be $450,000 to build new bridges and culverts and upgrade access infrastructure in our state forest system. $100,000 for mapping of of an immense area of windblown trees in the interior that will be pretty soon a fire and insect hazard situation. $250,000, which will match to $650,000 Forest Service money for inventory of our biomass resources, which we're getting more and more pressure to produce sales for biomass instead of normal saw timber, and then $100,000 to do reforestation in the Tanana Valley State Forest. Next project is a National Recreational Trail Grant federal program. This is primarily a federal program. That's our reference number 6854 on page 27. It's a $1.7 million grant program, 1.5 of federal receipts and $200,000 of general fund to give matching grants to communities and groups to build and improve trails in Alaska. The next project is the National Historic Preservation Fund, reference number 6865 on page 32. Another primarily federal grant program, $800,000, $650,000 federal and $150,000 of general fund match. Again, this is a grant program to give matching funds to communities and groups to improve and preserve historic facilities. The next project, the Knick River Public Use Area Target Shooting Facility, design and construction. Phase 2 of 3, reference number 56460, page 36. This would be phase 2 of the design of this shooting facility. Phase 1, we got last year. We've spent about $50,000 of that to design the facility. With phase 2, we'll be able to do all the dirt work and create the facility. We will need phase 3 next year to build the support facilities, such as firing line benches and toilets. The next project is the public access and user facility improvements, the mouth of the Kostilov River, phase 2, reference number 51197, page 39 of your book. This will be phase 2 of a project to harden up and improve facilities, a very heavily used dip netting area at the mouth of the Kostilov River. Phase 1, we've actually done all the design and let the contracts for access improvements, parking, and sanitation facilities, and they will be constructed this summer. This appropriation will be for phase 2 for additional parking and camping. The next project is the Seward Peninsula Port Clarence Port Development Project, reference number 58598, page 42 of your book. This project would allow us to work with Bering Straits Native Corporation and the U.S. Coast Guard to first and foremost settle the land issues up there so that we can figure out a way to spur the development of a deepwater port for future Arctic development. The next project is the South Denali Visitor Center, Phase 2, for $1.235 million, reference number 57282 on page 44. This would begin the phase 2 of this project. We've received a total of about $22.4 million over a number of capital appropriations to date. This has enabled us to essentially acquire all the funding and start construction of one of the flagship state park facilities in the state, with a large campground with electricity. A side benefit to what we've accomplished so far is to also energize 34 miles of the park's highway with new power lines. This would start phase 2, which would be the design of the ultimate build out, which would someday be a visitor facility on top of the mountain with its expansive views of Denali.
Mr. Chairman,
Go ahead, Senator Hoffman. Go ahead, Ed.
Okay. The next project, the Abandoned Mine Lands Reclamation Federal Program. This is a continuation of our longstanding Abandoned Mine Lands Program, which is funded entirely by federal monies that are derived from fees on coal production in the nation. And we've been eliminating hazards from old pre-regulatory law coal mines in Alaska, and the current projects are in Healy to mitigate steep, crumbling, dangerous high walls left over from historic mining. The next project is the Cooperative Water Resource Program, reference number 37762, page 48. This is $2.5 million of statutory designated program receipts. This is an authorization to let us pass through money from, mining companies like Red Dog that want the federal government to do water quality and quantity monitoring. The federal government can't take that money directly from the mining operator, so we use this program to pass it through and enable those activities to happen.
Okay. We could maybe try to finish up here in the next 5 minutes.
Okay.
We're going to have to go to floor session.
I will speak
and I know
up.
People have questions, and I apologize for that, but okay. Perhaps we can follow up directly. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, the next project is the Snowmobile Trail Development Program, reference number 33690, page 50, $250,000 of vehicle receipts to maintain our snow machine trails grant program for improving grooming and snow machine trails. The next program is the National Coastal Wetlands Grant Program, reference number 39042, $1 million of federal receipts that will allow us to do an Exxon Valdez purchase of some land at Fognac Island. Next program is the Federal and Local Government Funded Forest Resource and Fire Program, reference number 37769, $1.8 million will allow us to work with municipalities to do fire mitigation programs throughout the state.
Okay, very good. I think the rest is all deferred maintenance, right? Okay.
Right. There's a EVOS parcel. That's, an amendment that will come later, too. So but the rest is deferred.
We understand the need for deferred maintenance. So maybe some Department of Labor will do you first tomorrow. I guess we are having amendments from Ms. Rayfield first, and then we'll take up labor and then continue on with the schedule. Is there any quick questions? I know Senator Hoffman, Faircloth, Bishop, you had some. Anything?
Pass.
Your pass?
Pass.
Senator Faircloth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just noticed that starting on page, I believe it was on the first project, I see personnel costs on each one of the lines in the backup document. Is that new personnel? Or is it contract personnel? Is it just putting people to work that already are working in the department and you're allocating costs?
For the record, Jean Davis and through the chair, Senator Faircloth, all of those are for existing positions that we have now. A lot of them are non-perms, long-term non-perms that we've had on the books and on these projects for a while. Some of them are our permanent positions that do work on the projects. We just allocate their cost into the capital project and identify it there.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Davis, do non-perms draw retirement and health benefits?
Again, through the chair, a long-term non-perm is not in the retirement system, but they would be drawing health benefits, I believe. There's a variety of kinds of non-perms.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. You need to just follow up on that? Okay, so tomorrow, as I mentioned, we'll have a presentation by Karen Rayfield on the budget amendments. We'll finish labor. Sorry we didn't get you guys. And then the other three should be fairly quick. Not much capital in education, fishing game, and Department of Revenue. So with that, we're adjourned till tomorrow at 9. Or I'm sorry, we do have a meeting tonight, everybody, at 5 o'clock. Different topic. I guess we're taking up the gas tonight. So we're adjourned till 5 o'clock tonight.
Welcome to Senate Finance. It is, here we go, October. It is February the 19th, 2014 at 5 o'clock, about 5 after 5. And we're going to have an overview of some of the issues surrounding SB 138. We do not have the bill before us. This is an informational meeting. We anticipate that the bill will get to us next week sometime, but I just wanted to make sure the committee was up to speed, although I know a lot of you are and have invested a lot of time in learning about this. I thought it would be good to get some perspectives maybe that that we hadn't had so far. So the first person that I asked to come and just kind of give us a general overview and his thoughts on all things gas line related is Larry Persily. Larry, if you'd like to come up and, you know, the drill, state your name and affiliation and tell us what's on your mind. Again, make sure everybody knows Senator Fairclough is at the table, along with Senator Dunleavy, Senator Hoffman, Senator Meyer, and myself, Senator Kelly.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Larry Persily. I'm the head of the Federal Alaska Gas Line Project Office. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today at Senate Finance, and I hope my comments are useful and answer some of your questions. I guess what I'd like to start with this time is to explain why this time may turn out differently than all the other attempts at an Alaska gas pipeline project throughout the years. But first, I want to share with you a couple of examples of Washington taking notice of what's happening on this project. And I know normally Alaskans don't like to hear that the federal government is watching over our resource development, but this time it's okay, really. It's one of these trust me, but I didn't want to use that line, trust me, I'm from the federal government. I presented an update on the Alaska LNG project last week at the Department of Interior. I was speaking to the Alaska Interagency Working Group, which was created by a presidential executive order almost 3 years ago to track and help coordinate the work of federal resource agencies at onshore and offshore energy projects in Alaska. As I started talking about the Alaska Gas Line project, people actually paid attention. They asked good questions. They've heard about Alaska Gas many, many times before through the years. Their agencies have spent a lot of time on the many false starts we've had on this project through the decades, but they had heard and they had read recently that this time might be different, and they were eager to know what was happening. They had heard that all of the players are working together on the same project, and they're spending serious money to determine if Alaska's time finally has come. Between budget cuts, retirements, other staffing reductions, however, federal resource management and regulatory agencies just don't have spare time for another false start, like they went through just a few years ago with a proposed pipeline from Alaska to serve North American markets. You know, though sponsors of that project certainly worked in good faith trying to put the deal together, shale gas put an end to it. We know that now, but not before federal agencies had spent a lot of time on permitting issues, rights of way, scoping meetings, reviewing thousands of pages of draft resource reports for an environmental impact statement. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the Department of Energy, the Bureau of Land Management, Army Corps of Engineers, others, have more than enough work on their desks without an Alaska gas line. FERC alone has several lower 48 LNG export terminals on their work list for environmental reviews, EISs. The Department of Energy has 24 LNG export applications waiting for review, including the applications from the existing ConocoPhillips plant at Nikiski. You know, federal agencies are the same as Alaskans. They don't want another false start on an Alaska gas line project, but every one of those agencies, when I talked to them last week, is ready to work on this project just as soon as an application hits their desk. They would like to know that this time we have a real shot at making it work. And I told them the same thing I'm going to tell you, and this is coming from someone who, I swear, I'm still cynical and skeptical about life, but I'm going to tell you this, like I say, same thing I told them. This time very well may be different for the Alaska Gas Line. If the markets perform as expected, if the companies and the state can keep the cost down, if the financial terms look good to all parties, I think gas would flow in the 2020s down that line. And another non-skeptic in Washington in the federal government is Adam Siminski, who is head of the Energy Information Administration at the U.S. Department of Energy. He said in an Energy Newsletter interview this week, "We think the economics ultimately will favor construction of an LNG facility in Alaska." One of the more positive statements coming out of the Energy Information Administration for in a long time on this project. So why this time? Why might this be different? And I'll tell you what's working in our favor. Global LNG demand is the strongest growth industry for energy in the world. Between nuclear plant shutdowns in Japan and Korea, choking coal pollution in China, population, economic growth in India, China, and elsewhere across Southeast Asia, high oil prices that make LNG look affordable by comparison, they all add up to a strong demand for LNG in the Asian market. The International Energy Agency predicts global demand for natural gas to grow twice as fast as oil over the next 20 years. Others predict even stronger growth for gas. Most of the world's gas trade is by pipeline, but LNG is building and building at an even faster pace than pipeline deliveries. Now, many analysts are talking of about a 5% to 6% annual growth rate for LNG demand through 2020, slowing down a little bit to 2 to 3% growth range through 2035. That's per year. What that adds up to, what that means is the equivalent of a new good-sized LNG export terminal will need to start up almost every year somewhere in the world to meet that demand growth. In addition to market growth, older LNG supply contracts are expiring, and some of those older export plants are running low on reserves. Just this week, Egypt, which has been an LNG exporter for the past 10 years, announced it will need to import LNG for the next several years as gas production is falling short of domestic demand. Now, all of which means that export project developers are chasing not only that new demand growth, but replacement contracts for declining reserves from other projects. Someone is going to win that business, and it will be the lowest cost, stable, predictable suppliers. The potential competitors for Alaska have their own strengths and weaknesses, as does Alaska. And make no doubt about it, there are a lot of potential competitors. There is no shortage of natural gas in the world. But I'd like to talk about our competitors' weaknesses for a few minutes to give you a sense of there is hope, there is possibility, we have a real shot at this. Australia, certainly people hear about it. There are 7 LNG export projects under construction in Australia that are set to open over the next 3 years. But most of that gas is already sold on long-term contracts. Those projects are not our competition for deliveries starting in the 2020s. New terminals, new projects, expansions in Australia face tough hurdles. Cost overruns on those projects under construction have got companies worried about repeating history. Domestic consumers in Australia are seeing price increases for natural gas, which is being drawn from the local market to feed the higher-priced export markets. Dow Chemical last week made headlines saying it could not get new gas supply contracts it needs for investments in Australia. And some local jurisdictions in Australia have imposed drilling restrictions on coal bed gas reserves, which are feeding 3 of those export terminals under construction. Russia is another competitor we hear about. Russia has just 1 operating export plant. There's talk of expanding it. Russia has another plant under construction and thoughts of 2 more. The expansion talk at Sakhalin 2, which is led by operators Gazprom and partner Shell, is dependent on sufficient gas reserves to feed to justify that expansion. Gazprom is also talking about building an LNG terminal at Vladivostok in the Russian Far East. Great location for marketing. It's a short, very short tanker trip from Vladivostok to Japan, to Korea, China, Taiwan, 4 of the biggest LNG players. but it will take a 2,500-mile pipeline to move the gas from Russia's interior to the coast to that terminal. The field development costs alone and the pipeline are estimated at $40 billion, not counting the liquefaction terminal. To make the economics work on a project that size, Russia really needs to extend that pipeline project and sell gas into China to get enough volume, enough economies of scale. China and Russia have agreed on everything but the price for the gas, which essentially means they've agreed on nothing. Yeah. And just on a sidelight, this is a big project, a big dream in Russia, this 2,500-mile pipeline. So Gazprom actually ran a contest to name the project. The winning name was Power Siberia. I guess that's a good name. What I found interesting is, big country, a lot of people live in Russia. They only got 130 entries in this contest, and I guess I figure it's because the prize was a trip for two to Siberia. You know, you got to figure the prize has got to be good enough or no one enters, and you look at the fine print, it didn't say round trip, it just said trip for two to Siberia. So separately, you've got Rosneft and ExxonMobil. They're doing due diligence for an LNG plant called Sakhalin 1. They have issued a contract, but only for their initial feed work, front-end engineering design. In Russia's Arctic, a terminal is under construction. It's called Yamal LNG. To give you an idea of where it is, it's about halfway between Nome and Iceland. Right. It's sort of out there in the middle of nowhere up in the Arctic. That project is estimated at $27 billion. The sponsors talk of making the first deliveries in 3 or 4 years. Here's the tricky part. The hard part for Yamal is the Northern Sea Route to Asia, which will be passable for LNG tankers to serve Asian customers, but it's only going to be passable a few months a year, and even then only with government-funded nuclear-powered icebreakers as escorts. The rest of the year, their plan is to ship the LNG aboard ice-class tankers to European ports, where they will transfer the LNG to less expensive standard tankers, and then those tankers will take the long way to Asia, down the European coast, through the Mediterranean Sea, through the Suez Canal, across the Indian Ocean into Asia. You look at that map and you realize the economic challenges that project faces, plus the main sponsor, a Russian company called Novatek, has never built or operated an LNG plant. Canada, a little closer to home, another competitor, multiple proposals, about a dozen, give or take. None have all of their government authorizations or a final investment decision. None have cleared the consultation process with every First Nation in the area and along the pipeline route. And the developers in British Columbia that are talking about price are emphatic that they need oil-linked LNG pricing or something comparable to cover the sizable development costs of their projects. There is no Prudhoe Bay production facility in British Columbia's Horn River and Montney shale gas plays that would produce the gas to feed the terminals at Kitimat and Prince Rupert. They're going to have to build it, and gas is going to have to pay for it, not oil. The pipelines that would move that gas from northeast British Columbia to the coast are as long as 525 miles, and they must go through two mountain ranges, Rocky Mountains and Coast Mountains. One of the possible routes into Prince Rupert takes the pipeline offshore for up to 75 miles, and their choice is to either cross an old mine tailings disposal site or a mollusk habitat bed that's important to First Nations people. Sort of pick your environmental headache, mine tailings or mollusk habitat. You know, meanwhile, the British Columbia government is negotiating a new LNG export tax with project sponsors. That legislation has been delayed until fall, and the companies are saying, hey, no decisions till we know the tax. One other foreign competitor, Tanzania, Mozambique, awful lot of gas. More than 100 trillion cubic feet have been discovered offshore of the East African nations, but minimal infrastructure in those two countries. They're still developing their oil and gas tax laws, their fiscal regimes, and certainly local poverty could be an issue for developers and politics. Closer to home, lower 48 states, awash in natural gas. A lot of companies want to get in the export business, but it is a tough political battle. You're pitting oversupply and low prices at home versus the free market and whether you should sell to our trading partners. the U.S. Department of Energy. Federal approval is required for any exports from this country. The Department of Energy has approved 6 export licenses totaling 8.5 billion cubic feet a day of gas, and that's equal to almost 12% of current U.S. gas production. The unknown is if and when and under what conditions the department might start to close down or delay export approvals in the lower 48. Regardless what the government does, the only terminals are going to be built. And even though they've approved 6, I don't think 6 get built, much less the rest that are waiting, but the only ones that are going to be built are the ones that have buyers and can get financing, and just one so far is under construction at Sabine Pass, Louisiana. Another issue for lower 48 exports include the cost overruns for construction of the Panama Canal expansion, which is essential for getting those tankers out of the Gulf Coast and into the Pacific. One of the Gulf Coast LNG export project sponsors said this week that Asian buyers are starting to put off long-term contracts for U.S. lower 48 gas because of the delay in knowing just how much it's going to cost for tolls to move ships through the expanded canal. Local opposition over environmental and safety concerns, not that noticeable in the Gulf Coast, certainly long history of oil and gas on the U.S. Gulf Coast, but environmental safety issues extremely visible for terminals that are proposed for the Oregon coast and the Maryland coast on Chesapeake Bay. And my point in all this is that Alaska, like every other proposed project, all of our competitors, they all have their own problems, their own disadvantages, their own issues to solve. If it was easy, they would have been built already. The winners, the LNG export projects around the world that get built, will be the ones that can solve the problems, the ones that can hold down their costs, the ones that can convince buyers they will start up on time with competitive prices. But the winners will be built. The pre-feed and feed work, as we're learning, front-end engineering and design, is a key part of that effort. The more you do up front, the better the odds of avoiding surprises during construction. And in a brief plug for our office, we issued a report today on just what are pre-feed and feed, why they're so important, and it's available at our website, arcticgas.gov. So to sort of close, what are Alaska's advantages in being one of those winning projects? And the advantages for us are meaningful and are very substantial. It's a much shorter tanker run from Nikiski to Japan, 1 week versus 3 weeks from the U.S. Gulf Coast. LNG tanker charter rates are running $75,000 to $100,000 a day. Time is money, and big money at those rates if it's a 1 week run instead of 3. Or if you're going to do owner-operated tankers, certainly a lot less capital tied up if you don't need as many ships. Alaska's gas reserves are proven. They're already being produced, and it's important to buyers to know that the gas that they're committing to buy for 15 or 20 or 25 years actually exists. No risks. We have low production costs compared to greenfield projects in British Columbia, Australia, East Africa. Oil will carry the infrastructure costs in Alaska, where we've had almost 40 years of producing on the North Slope and more than 40 years experience exporting gas from Cook Inlet. Liquefaction compressors run much more efficiently at cold temperatures, up to 15% more efficient, less gas consumed in the process than in a warm climate. But back to reality, we have disadvantages in Alaska, and they are just as substantial and just as meaningful. We have high construction costs, seasonal construction limitations, such as pipeline trenching only in the winter. The summer-only sea lifts of material to the North Slope make life harder. Environmental considerations, wetlands, air quality standards, mitigation expenses are an issue here. The cost of an 800-mile pipeline to Tidewater. Our competitors don't have one that long or that expensive. Another disadvantage, I guess, something everybody changes, markets could change. Japan could restart nuclear power. China could say the heck with air pollution and just burn coal, not bother going ahead with their plans to convert to natural gas. And a serious issue, and this is not a comment on legislation, but we all know anything dealing with oil and gas politics is a tough sell in this state. We've got to resolve this if this project's going to go ahead. Speaking for the federal government, we are ready for the permitting work, but making the finances work Well, that's up to the project sponsors, the companies, and the state. The rewards to the state of a successful gas line project include substantial public revenue for decades, the lowest cost for moving gas to Alaskans, and an industry commitment to keep North Slope oil and gas flowing for decades. The risks of a state investment in a project, certainly construction cost overruns, especially if you're facing budget deficits, and there is the possibility that the project will not make as much money as people projected or as people want, but long term it will still make money if it's built. And I can't help you with those political risks, those fiscal risks, other than to say the LNG world is competitive, but it's not an impossible market. We could get in there. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Larry. Appreciate it. I just want to make a quick comment that Senator Bishop and Senator Fairclough are going to have to take off, like right now, I think, for the Resources Committee hearing on this very bill. And Senator Olson joined us, and I think I did not mention, Senator Fairclough, that you joined us. I didn't mention that Senator Olson and Senator Bishop joined us. So I think I've got everybody covered. The whole committee is here, for the record. So questions? We'll wait till we just take a quick break at ease. Question. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Larry, for that presentation. Larry, or Mr. Pursley, I'm just curious, who's going to oversee the pipeline? Is this FERC or RCA or both?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer. Under federal law, FERC will take the environmental and safety review on the liquefaction project, the plant itself. There's no question about that. Some ambiguity, 2005 law nailed it. FERC will do the EIS and issue an authorization for construction and operation of the liquefaction plant. Under that federal law, FERC has the option of asserting that same environmental and safety review all the way up the line as far as they want to go. FERC will not regulate the tariffs on the liquefaction plant or on the pipeline because there's no interstate commerce in there, and the law precludes FERC from getting in the tariff regulation business on a liquefaction plant. But that pipeline is not interstate commerce. It has to do with different sections of the Natural Gas Act. So to answer your question, FERC will do an EIS, certainly will be in charge for the liquefaction plant. It's up to FERC if they want to do the pipeline too. It makes sense to have one EIS because it really is in one project. FERC will have to wait till it gets an application and then at that time decide.
On that point, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Even though it's not interstate commerce and even though it's international commerce, FERC will still not get involved with that?
No. As a matter of law, Congress has told FERC, and FERC's had some decisions where it's, well, first of all, FERC has acknowledged that LNG is traded differently than gas in the law 48 through the chair, Senator Olson, that LNG projects only get built with long-term fiscal certainty, which means you have contracts up front, and tariff regulation on an annual basis is going to get in the way of that. But the law that gave FERC that absolute authority over the environmental safety review siting of liquefaction plants told them you can't condition these things on tariff regulations. It's just...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Meyer.
Yeah, to continue, The price of gas in the open market seems to be all over the place. I've seen as low as $6 and up to 16, maybe even higher. You know, if everything works as planned and hoped, what would you anticipate our gas would go for, and where do we make any money at that price?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer.
Because the prices seem to be downward trending.
And you're talking about LNG prices, right? In Asia, not yes. U.S. prices. There are a lot of old contracts out there in the Asian market, and some buyers got some very good prices. There are some projects in Australia that went on the market, and they needed buyers. It was a much different market than it was today. Not so many projects out there. So there's some old projects where out of Australia, out of Yemen, out of Equatorial Guinea, where gas is being sold pretty cheap. Those countries are trying to renegotiate prices. Yemen LNG recently negotiated on a five-year opener with their contract with the Korea Gas, much higher prices. So some of the old contracts were linked to oil, but they might have had price caps. China also is a beneficiary of a very low-cost contract from Indonesia, so it may have been linked to oil up to $30 or $40 a barrel, and then it stopped because years ago we all thought 30 or 40 was heaven for oil prices. We never dreamed about $100. You never thought of it could go that high. The contracts, the newer ones, are the ones that you most often think about, linked to oil. The current price is $14, $15, $16 per million BTU. So what Alaska could get, certainly the buyers in Asia know there are a lot of new suppliers chasing after their business. And they're certainly playing one off against another, so it's the most dependable buyers with the lowest cost that will get contracts. Current spot price is around $18 per million BTU, I believe, in Asia. You're not going to get that price, but you'll do a lot better than some of the old Russian contracts at six or Indonesian contracts at three, because you can't produce it at that cost. Those are old projects.
And this may be an unfair question. What do you think we would have to make our project economical?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer. And I don't know what it's going to cost per million BTU to run gas to the liquefaction plant. I've certainly seen Black and Veatch and the legislative consultants' estimates, but I don't know what that final cost is going to be. I guess it's also a question, the state as an owner of the gas and the producers, how much do they want as a netback? Are they willing to get into the market at a lower netback and hopefully ride the market as it improves, as prices rise in 30, 40 years? But all the numbers I've seen tell me we can be competitive with the other projects. They've got their own cost problems, their own other hurdles, their own dependability issues, but it's not going to be today's spot price of $18. If I can, Mr. Chairman, the Wood Mackenzie National Energy Consultancy Firm did a report for the Alaska Gas Line Port Authority a couple years ago where they said the state would make, I think, $500 billion over the life of the project. What they did is took that day's very high spot price for LNG in Asia and then applied an annual inflation to it of 3%. So 30 years out, I think they said the gas was going to, we were going to get $45 per million BTU. Well, of course, with set fixed expenses. Expenses don't rise, but the price of the commodity goes up 3% a year. Well, of course, under that, you're going to make $500 billion, but it's monopoly money because no one's going to sign a contract like that. It was a very misleading study. My point being, I think, if it gets built, you get a decent price, but not today's spot price. You're going to get a contract price.
Senator Meyer?
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. One last question. Again, try and keep this at this meeting at a high level. But I think I mentioned this one other time in another committee meeting. This just seems like deja vu. Maybe I've lived in the state too long. Maybe I'm getting too old. But, you know, there's been the Port Authority. There's been ANGDA, there's been AGEA, there's been a Bullet Line, there's been Denali, and now we have this one. What makes this one different? Why are you optimistic about this one?
Go ahead, Larry.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, what changes the market? Until about 2008, Asian market wasn't paying a high enough price for LNG that you could have covered the cost of producing the gas, cleaning it, piping it, liquefying it, and getting it to Asia. Anyone before that would have lost money on every molecule they sent to Asia. So the markets because they're tied to oil and oil has gone up and there's so much demand, and this acceptance that the only way you finance these things is with long-term contracts at a sufficient price to cover the capital costs, it looks like the market is there, the price structure is there. The question now is, can we be competitive on price with all those other people chasing the same market?
I said that would be my last one, but this is just right a follow-up to it. Okay. Could it be, too, that this one is different in the sense that it's a partnership, that we are actually partnering with the industry? And I guess I've also been public about that, saying that I think that's the best way for the state to go after pipeline. But also, too, it's a little risky, I think, in the sense that the oil companies have other options. So you could get partway down this process, and they might say, hey, this is too risky, or it's not panning out like we want. We're going to abandon this project and go somewhere else. We don't have any other options.
Right. Through the chair, Senator Meyer, you're right. We don't. This is our mother load up there on the North Slope, and we need to develop oil and gas to have a sustainable economy. Companies can go somewhere else. Certainly, I mean, I can tell you people in Washington have noticed this time is different because you do have the three major producers holding hands. They don't love each other. Certainly, federal officials know that. The companies are very competitive. They don't always get along. But on this one, they seem to be walking in the same direction, not exactly to a military cadence, but they're stepping at the same speed, holding hands in the same direction. That gives people some hope, gives me some hope. And between that and the market, and that maybe after 40 years of oil production on the North Slope, the economics are such, if this project goes ahead, if they make a final investment decision, the companies can then take those 34 trillion cubic feet of gas reserves on the North Slope and book them on their balance sheets as reserves. Until there's a commitment to a pipeline, they cannot book them as reserves. 34 trillion cubic feet of gas is about 6 billion barrels of oil equivalent. If you can put 6 billion barrels of oil on your collective balance sheets, that certainly is a prize for any company trying to look to the future. That also works in our favor.
Thank you.
You talked a lot about the disadvantages that our competitors have, and you also talked a little bit about the disadvantages that we have, kind of putting everybody on the same even playing field. Your gut is we're ahead of the others, or in about the same place, or it's a kind of an apples to oranges comparison because everybody's problems are different? Did that question make sense?
Yeah, it does. Okay. Mr. Chairman, we're ahead in that we know the gas is there. There's no exploration.
Right.
We're ahead that we've got the facilities built and operating companies. And we're behind in that it's going to take longer to build it in Alaska than it would somewhere else because of Arctic conditions, environmental issues, winter-only construction, the size of the project, the long lead time. I think probably about even, I guess I would say. We're ahead on some, behind on others. Certainly some of the issues they're facing in Canada where there's a lot of gas in northeast British Columbia, no question about it, but getting it to the coast is not going to be that easy. There are some environmental problems. There's First Nations issues. British Columbia, the government just this week rolled out some aspects of the tax proposal, but they won't have the details till fall. And what their proposal is a low tax in the early years until the project sponsors have recovered their capital expenditures, and then the tax ramps up. So it starts off at about 1.5% of net, and then after cost recovery goes to 7%. This is a different way of partnering. You know, we're looking at partnering here as investors. They're partnering by reducing their tax take until the cost recovery. So they've got to work that out, and as we know, no oil and gas debate ever goes quickly.
So there are a lot of contracts out there that are maturing, and that puts us in a competitive advantage. But many of those are spoken for. I think you said down in Australia that they aren't really, you wouldn't really even consider them one of our competitors because the projects that they have going already are linked up with some contracts that have matured and
They have their long-term contracts. I'm not sure if you made the point that they were connecting with mature contracts.
Mr. Chairman, so of these projects being built in Australia, they're coming online 2014, 15, 16, 17. They're coming online because when they made their final investment decision, they locked up 60, 70% or more of their supply in long-term contracts. So they're not our competitors in the sense that they've already sold most of their gas. You know, they've held some back for spots, still looking for some other sales. But when BP, Conoco, Exxon, State of Alaska goes out and tries to sign contracts for 2023, 2024, whatever it is on, we're looking at utilities that have unmet needs from that period forward, and our competitors are going to be other unsanctioned projects also trying to strike their deals so they can make those sanctions, those decisions.
The Australian projects that you described with the problems that they have, any possibility that they can't deliver?
Mr. Chairman, no. The seven under construction, I believe, will all be completed, some under varying degrees of cost overruns and delays. And I think the ones that are having cost overruns, they will still be profitable projects. Over the life of them, they will still make a lot of money for their project sponsors. Just make less money in the early years than they thought because they're going to have more capital to recover. But they will still be profitable projects.
How much are we depending on for the future for a healthy Chinese economy?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Japan buys a lot more LNG currently than China. But long term, when you look at a growing economy and population and industrial development, a lot of LNG project sponsors look toward China. So that's a sizable chunk of the market. China has other options, not just burning coal. China gets about half of its imported gas by pipeline from Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan. So China's going to look at where is it cheaper, pipeline or LNG, but also China's physically so immense, just because they can bring pipeline gas in from Turkmenistan to one side of the country doesn't mean it's economical to move it all the way across China. It may be more economical to bring LNG into their coastal communities. So growth is a key part of this demand.
Do you have any insights on how this is going to be financed, kind of from a 30,000-foot view?
Mr. Chairman, the projects that are under construction in Australia and Papua New Guinea, and Cheniere Energy at Sabine Pass, Louisiana, once you have those binding long-term contracts,
the money will come.
People line up, whether it's commercial banks, whether it's U.S. Export-Import Bank, whether it's the equivalent of the Export-Import Bank from other nations, there is financing, but it's not just one. I mean, you'll see a dozen or two dozen lenders in there at different levels. No one is going to take all the risk on this, but there is financing, and current interest rates, it's relatively affordable.
Right.
Spoken as someone who took out a 16% mortgage once in 1982. And that was a bargain in 1982, Mr. Chair.
I remember. Senator Dunleavy?
Through the Chair. Larry, is it safe to say that some of Australia's customers and ours won't overlap? In other words, is it safe to say that Australia, India would be a customer for Australia gas more so than ours would be because of the proximity? That, and where we may overlap is your China, your Korea possibly, but we're not going to compete with Australia for India, are we?
Well, through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, yes, no, certainly if I've got a project in Australia, it's a lot shorter tanker run to India, and that gives me a competitive cost advantage over bringing it in from the U.S. Gulf Coast or Alaska or British Columbia or Vladivostok or Yamal in Russia. But I guess we're competitors in that in 2012, the total global trade in LNG was about 32 billion cubic feet, growing quite a bit. But still, you look at that, and if we've got 2.5 billion cubic feet we're trying to get in there, that's a sizable chunk of that market. I would expect that the producers here would be trying to sell everywhere they could on the Pacific Rim. Countries, I think we also need to remember the buyers don't want to be tied to just one supplier. You don't want to be utility wholly dependent on Australia or the U.S., and you certainly don't want to be wholly dependent on Putin and Russia. That's just not good business. So they like that diversity in their portfolio. They like a little bit from different places. So if there's a problem, someone else can fill their needs. And also a diversity in pricing. Maybe some is linked to oil. Maybe some to U.S. energy hub. Maybe some is a blend. Just like with our investment portfolio with the permanent fund, you don't want to just bet on one thing.
I just ask one more. And this was not part of your presentation, but you just reminded me of something that's kind of has me scratching my head. I've heard of various times that our gas has been recycled two or three times and the liquids have been stripped out and sent down the pipeline. But then again, I hear from other people that that's not the case, that we have liquids and that's why buyers want it because we have very rich gas. I've heard we only have ethane left in it to be stripped out for plastics, and I've heard others say, no, we have four or five different gases. What is the situation of our gas right now?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, actually our gas is, as they look out to 2020s and beyond for this project, from a BTU value is perfectly suited for Japan. Yes, the heavier gas liquids, the pentanes and butanes, what they have been able to strip out with in the past 30-some years, they have taken out as liquids, put into taps, sold in the liquids market, and made money, and the state has shared in those profits. But the methane, mostly, and the ethane, what's left in there is a high heat, high BTU gas that is perfectly suited for the Japanese market. It's higher than the U.S. market. If you were to sell North Slope gas into North American market, you'd have to take out the ethane. You'd have to water down the BTU content so it would work in furnaces and boilers in the lower 48, but it's perfect.
And one last follow-up. Is the Australian gas, is it mainly a coal bed methane type, or is it a combination?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, of the six land-based projects in Australia, half of those are conventional gas. The other half are coal bed methane gas, which does not have a high enough BTU content for the Japanese market. So they're going to have to either spike it with propane or other gas liquids to get the BTU value up, or they're going to have to adjust their burners and use it for, you can certainly take a gas-fired power generator and adjust it to run at a lower BTU value, but that makes the gas worth a little bit less because you're not getting as much energy off of it. And then you might have to have separate tanks to segregate that gas from the higher BTU gas from other customers. So three of those projects are coal bed methane, and they are a lower BTU value.
Any other questions? Larry, I really appreciate this. It's very good for the committee to get these kind of larger views of things. Sometimes we jump right into the weeds, and we don't get the history behind it. But that's very valuable to me, and I hope it has been for the rest of the committee. And thanks. Your report that you put out was very good. We read through it.
Thank you, Senator. And any questions, direct them my way. And if I'm wrong in anything, the good thing about the federal government is we're immune from litigation. You can't sue us for anything I said.
I once worked for a guy that they used to say, if I'm going to be wrong, it's going to be out loud and in great detail.
I have a whole federal government to protect me if I'm wrong. I got no risk.
Thanks a lot, Larry. Appreciate it.
I'm going to take just a real brief at ease here, and then we're going to have Ms. Potavel, with Black and Beach. Would you want to come up and get yourself ready, and then I'm going to take just a quick at ease, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back on the record. And we're going to hear from Ms. Potterball from Black and Veatch. I think I mentioned, you were in the room when I mentioned that Senator Bishop and Senator Fairclough are actually in a resources hearing regarding this topic right now. They actually have the bill before them. We don't. We're just trying to get some information at this point. And your name is Deepa?
That's correct.
As I understand, you're going to talk about the financing picture here and about the kind of a real high-level view of financing and ownership and those kinds of things. That's correct?
I'm focusing on the heads of agreement of the two main documents that you have, that you will have in front of you.
Thank you. Go ahead and state your name for the record, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Deepa Potterball. I'm a principal with Black and Veatch. I'm here in my capacity as the consulting firm that has supported the administration with economic analysis as well as commercial support. What I'm going to talk about today is starting from a royalty study, the North Slope royalty study that was commissioned by DNR last year, which looked at different aspects of the LNG market as well as a specific project, and made some recommendations in putting the heads of agreement that the administration has entered into with the producers as well as TransCanada within the context of the recommendations of that study. I want to recognize that my colleague Jason DeStichter is on the phone and available to answer questions as needed, but I intend to walk through the slides.
My apologies, Jason. I do have you on the sheet here, and we will throw to you from time to time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 3 here, what I wanted to underline is just why we are here and why the Alaska LNG project is important for Alaskans. And what we're showing are forecasted revenues from North Slope oil and gas, both with and without the Alaska LNG project. And so the blue line is showing a forecast that's based on DOR's estimate of oil production on the North Slope and what revenues associated with that would be. And the green line shows an Alaska LNG project coming online in 2024. And what it shows is that the LNG project can bring in revenues of $4 to $4.5 billion incrementally to the state above what the current forecast would be from the North Slope just based on oil production. And so it just helps to put in context for us what the opportunity can be from the project. Now, talking about the heads of agreement, the timeline and the development process for the Alaska LNG project is laid out here. And the first step that we're contemplating at this point is entering into a pre-FEED, and Larry referred to it as well in his testimony here. But it's the initial version of your front-end engineering and design work. And this is where you try and scope the project and you're working in concentric circles to get more and better information on the project's design and its cost. And the pre-FEED is the first step towards getting there. And that's contemplated to take about 18 months. Depending on the outcome of this legislative session, it could kick off mid-2014 and go through 2015. Next comes the FEED process, which is where the detailed engineering will be worked out, and the cost estimates for the project will be available at a much more granular level at that point. And that's anticipated to take anywhere from 2 to 3 years, including some of the permitting that work that gets done as that part of the process. At that point, you reach a decision point, which is the final investment decision. Somewhere between now and the end of FEED, these parties will have finalized their commercial agreements. And so they would have identified who the buyers for Alaska LNG would be, entered into sales and purchase agreements with those buyers. And so you, at that point, you have a pretty good estimate of what your costs are from the project and what your revenue stream can be. And that's the point that allows them to take an investment decision and say, this is a project that can be economic for each of our companies. And then you get into the construction, which for most projects is about 4 to 5, and it, you know, it could be a little longer here in Alaska, and we've seen a number of large projects suffer from delays. Putting in context what the expenditures would be for each of these different stages, at pre-FEED, we're talking about a very small proportion of the total project cost being at stake. It's, you know, somewhere in the range of 1%, 1 to 2% of cost. The millions of dollars of estimates that we're showing here would be the state's investment, assuming that you have TC in the mix or not, and what portion of equity you would take in the project. That reflects the range that's shown here. But in the first stage, like I said, it's about 1 to 2% of the total state's investment. You get to FEED, and you're spending another 3% at that point. And the big spend comes after you've taken that final investment decision, by which you have honed in and resolved a lot of the uncertainties around the project that can be resolved before you get to the construction. And that's where you spend, you know, more than 95% of the project's dollars. What the HOA contemplates is taking this process through the pre-FEED. Generally, in project development, it works through a stage-gated approach. And so you pass through one stage, and then all of the parties agree whether they want to go to the next stage or not. And at each stage, the parties are making commitments for spending the dollars that come in the next phase. And so the HOA is consistent with that approach for large project development in that it's committing each of the parties to do certain things to get the project through the pre-FEED stage. And so, you know, we fully expect that, as with any other large project, you will have more decisions, more information, and larger dollars at stake as this proceeds forward. And we're sort of at the starting point of that process where there's some money at stake and you're starting to get more information about the project. I mentioned the...
The percentage of investment is the percentage of the state's investment.
Correct? That's what we're showing here, and it would be proportional to the total project's investment as well. So summarizing here on slide 5 are the key findings from the North Slope Royalty Study that we conducted last year for DNR and the recommendations that come out of that. I have to mention here that we've boiled down to one slide what took us 2 to 3 hearings with those resources as well as Senate's resources. So you're getting the benefit of us having distilled that information down. The main findings were that the global LNG market is growing, and you heard that from Larry just before I was here, and it's competitive. There are a number of projects out there that all find that growing market attractive as well. The government take, as well as the cost structure for the Alaska LNG project, are both high. This will be an expensive project, and our estimated government take can be as high as 70% for this project, which would be a significant cost. The recommendations that came out of those findings were that, one, for this project to achieve commercial success, there's work to be done to improve its commercial attractiveness. And regarding the question of government take, as an objective to aspire to, you want to try and incentivize the project in a way that still retains value to the state. And so one way of doing it, you know, of incentivizing the project would be to reduce the government take. You know, and Larry referred to it when he talked about Canada. You can reduce your royalty, you can reduce your production tax, and that's one way to transfer value to the producers. But a goal that we were trying to achieve is, can we incentivize this project while retaining the state's value? Is there a way for us to participate in the project where we make the project look better for the producers, but we haven't necessarily eroded what the state's revenues would have been from this project under status quo? Moving on to the other key findings, I mentioned this before, but the Alaska LNG project is expected to be a large, complex, and high-cost project. It's actually three mega projects in one. The GTP pipeline and LNG plant each by itself would be considered a complex project. And given that, the project structure is likely to be integrated and producer-owned. The reason that generally happens in the LNG world is that having an integrated project structure improves your project controls. You don't have different owners for different pieces of the supply chain all having to coordinate their schedules and buying equipment and making sure each of the components comes online at the same time. When you have one integrated structure where you have an owner that goes all through the project, that helps to improve your project's controls. And so both from a cost perspective as well as a schedule perspective, that's beneficial.
Senator Dunleavy?
Yes. Thanks, Commissioner. Sorry to interrupt, but will we get to a point where you or somebody will lay out the various models that are in play worldwide now? In other words, what are the different models that are in play in the gas industry, LNG process?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, I am happy to do that now, or we can, I'm happy to have a discussion with you at another time. It's part of what we included in the royalty study. And basically, there are three main structures. The integrated structure that I'm highlighting here is the first one, and it's where you have a single ownership through the entire value chain. And so the same owners own, every piece of that value chain. In this case, it would be the GTP pipeline and LNG plant. A second structure is what's known as a merchant structure. And the way that could work here is that the upstream producers could sell the natural gas to the LNG plant, which is owned by a complete third party. The LNG plant will buy the gas and sell LNG. And so there's a transfer of ownership that happens. And so the LNG plant in that case acts as a merchant, buying gas, selling LNG.
Did you say merchant?
Merchant, yes. And the third most popular structure is a tolling arrangement, and it's tolling. And it's similar to what you see in pipeline contracts generally, where you get paid a service fee to provide a certain service. And so you could set it up to where you're paying the GTP and the pipeline and the LNG plant, a tariff to pass through, but the producers don't necessarily have to have ownership of those three.
Senator Dunleavy?
Through the chair, would we be able to get some type of printout of these three models with various provinces, states, areas that utilize the different models for us to take a look at?
Is that something we get from you?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, yes. That's okay. Something that we can put together
for you. And one last question just for now. We're looking at an integrated model for Alaska.
That's correct.
And can you briefly just explain why that model, and maybe you're going to, why that model best suits our particular circumstance here?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, project control is one of the most important reasons why an integrated project structure works for large, complex, especially high-cost projects, because the sponsors are generally very careful about managing their cost as well as schedule in a project like that. And so the integrated project structure gives them the ability to, start to finish, see that project through. The other part of why we're saying that the Alaska LNG project will be integrated is that's what the producers have said is their preference for this project.
Senator Dunleavy, did you have other questions?
I got a lot of questions, but I'll hold back.
Sure. Ms. Bonnell, go ahead.
Thank you. So some of the implications that come with having an integrated project is, you know, you've heard the benefits of it allowing that control, but the downside of that, especially from the state's perspective, is it could create a black box where we don't have access to information. We are unable to create, you know, any kind of open access for third parties. And from the state's perspective, that's important because, you know, one of the objectives for the state has been to incentivize other exploration and development on the North Slope. And being able to have a means to have third parties enter this project on some future date is important. And if you have a project that's completely controlled by the producers and integrated, one, you don't have access to information on that project. And two, access is not an option. It's just it's an Exxon project or a BP Conoco project. And one of the risks we highlighted for the state is that it could also create misalignment, where because the producers have the upstream as well as midstream, and this is, you know, not with nefarious instinct, but just as part of their fiduciary duties, they're going to transfer revenues to whichever side of that equation increases their take the most, and that is likely to come at a cost to the state. And so, for example, they could make the midstream look really expensive, by having an equity-rich financing arrangement, for example. So the tariff on the project looks really high, which makes your wellhead value low, and it lowers, you know, the royalty and production taxes that the state would receive. And so one of the recommendations then that came from the study was that given that we know that this project is large, complex, and it will have an integrated project structure, that whatever the state engages with the producers should help create alignment with them, where you minimize their incentive to need to behave like that. And then the last finding that I wanted to highlight here is that, there are various risks that are inherent in the project, as well as in the state participating in the project. There are risks whether or not the state participates. The cost structure of the project is a significant risk, and the LNG price is by far the most dominant risk for this project. Given that it's a high-cost project, the project is going to need the global LNG market to sustain this high level of demand and to have prices that are in the healthy teens or above to earn a return that would be attractive for the investors. And
Ms. Bonneville, could I stop you just for a second? We back up just a bit. I'm going to ask kind of an odd question. We hear the word alignment thrown around. I think it has a specific meaning that I may not know. I have my idea of what alignment is. You just said something that sounded like alignment had a specific definition. Could you talk a little about what you think alignment is?
Mr. Chairman, when I think of alignment, I think about all of the parties having a seat at the table, all of the parties having their incentives around a project lined up similarly. And so, the example I gave you before is a good one to highlight where a producer's motivation and incentive from a project could be different from what the state would need from the project. I'm trying to think of another example, but
well, you talked a little bit about the black box, I've heard that discussed before. If you could just run through that again.
Sure. TAPS is probably the best example of this, where, you know, it's a producer-owned oil pipeline, and that has created over the years a number of disputes with the producers at every step of the way on how it should be valued, what the tariff should be going through that project. And all of that happens because it creates a relationship where you're at the opposite sides of a table, right? One party wins, the other loses. And anytime you have that dynamic, it creates inefficiency in the project, essentially. We talked about the economic you know, shifting of revenues between upstream and midstream in a way that could hurt the state. But if you think about some other important objectives to the state from this project, which are open access and being able to allow third parties to bring, you know, to develop the North Slope and bring more oil and gas revenues to the state, that's not necessarily an incentive that the producers would have or an objective that they would have from this project. And there's another example where if the state was not part of the project, you're at the mercy of the producers, essentially, in that respect, in being able to procure access for anybody else into this project.
Senator Dunleavy?
Again, going back, there's different models for reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I heard is that this model seems to be, at this stage of the game, appropriate for Alaska because of the scale.
And complexity.
And complexity. And there's other projects worldwide in which they use the integrated model, and the concept of alignment is embedded in there, correct?
Yes.
If you have an integrated model, alignment is also part of that, correct? Or not always?
Not always, generally true, I think.
So there are integrated models that are not in alignment.
Well, I want to say that is generally true. When you have an integrated model, it creates alignment. Of course, it depends on who the parties are that are part of that integrated project. You don't always have the state as a participant in those integrated projects. You have just the project sponsors. And they, you know, whoever the producers are, they own the upstream as well as the midstream. It creates alignment between them. It doesn't necessarily create alignment between them and the state or country.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead, Ms. Potter.
Thank you. And so putting all of the pieces together, the ultimate recommendation of the study was that the state should consider an equity participation as a way of improving the commercial attractiveness of the project, retaining value for the state, and getting something in return for the incentive that you would be providing to the project, and to create alignment between the state and the producers. We looked at different ways of state equity participation and recommended that participation along the entire value chain would be the most beneficial, again, for the reasons of creating access through the entire value chain and having access to information through the entire value chain.
By the way, I was going to also state, Senator Dunleavy, questions that you were asking about the different models, that's part of a PowerPoint that you have that's a much more involved PowerPoint, I think, and if
it is,
either we can get it to you or you get it from Ms. Potterville. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So starting on slide 6, moving to the specifics in the heads of agreement that the state has put in front of you and measuring that agreement against the criteria in the royalty study. And we're trying to understand here, were each of these objectives met, you know, and to what extent they were met by the heads of agreement. And again, the four criteria that we're looking at here is, one, create alignment through an equity participation. Two is help improve the commercial attractiveness of the project. Three is preserve value to the state. And fourth is manage associated risks. On slide 7, we look at the first one. Does the HOA create alignment through equity participation? I think the short answer is yes, and the different elements that the HOA defines that get you to that point are, first, it establishes what's the state gas share. And so it's saying we'll take royalty gas and we'll take tax as a gross share of gas, and that together, royalty gas as well as tax gas together, creates your total share of gas from the project. The next concept it lays out is that the state will invest equity in the project that's equal to its gas share. And so each party essentially will have a share of gas and an equivalent share of equity in the project. The equity share that the state has is going to impact both its investment into the project, but also the revenues that the state earns from the project. As as it's envisioned in the HOA, the state would hold equity along the entire supply chain. And the last element here is that the commitments are envisioned to be made in a stage-gated manner. And so we risk fewer dollars up front when we don't have enough information. And as you go through the process and procure more information and more certainty around the project, then the state has, like the producers, more and more dollars at stake. And so between all of those elements, it gets the state to a point where alignment can be achieved, because you're sort of equivalent to the producers in that everyone has a share of the gas and everyone has a share of the entire project. And so you're sort of rowing together in that boat. And as the producers have put it, you know, the state has skin in the game. Next, we look at the objective of improving the commercial attractiveness of the project. And what we're showing here is the impact on the producer rate of return over the project. And the blue bar here shows what the return would be under status quo. I want to stop here and highlight what we're calling modified status quo, just because we're going to be seeing that again in subsequent slides. And modified status quo assumes that there's going to be something that needs to change from a fiscal perspective for gas before this project has any chance at all of moving. And so it assumes that a production credit similar to what's applied on oil gets provided to gas. And so it's a $5 per barrel of oil equivalent credit is applied to gas as well. Okay, so that's the one modification to the world as it is today. And that's the watermark against which we're measuring. Well, if we didn't do that but had an equity participation instead, what does that do for the state? Okay. And so what this shows is that there's an improvement in the producer IRR by 3 to 4% from the state participating in the project. And the main advantage for the producers and what we see here happening in the return is that it reduces their upfront capital costs. Without the state's participation in the project, the producers would have borne 100% of the capital costs associated with this project, but only had, you know, 7/8 of the gas, essentially, right? If you allow for the fact that royalty gas is not really theirs, it's the state's. And so because the state will participate and contribute capital cost up front in the project, what it does is it equates their capital investment to their share of the gas. And that reduction in their upfront capital cost helps to improve their returns over the life of this project. And from a commercial perspective, a couple of other elements that make this more attractive for the producers is that, one, now all of the risks are shared with the state. If there's a capital cost overrun, for example, the state is, you know, going to pick up its share of it as well. And it reduces valuation disputes if the state elects RIK. And, you know, with the RIV world, there's, as we've experienced with TAPS, that is an ongoing burden that both sides have to constantly be working on, establishing what the net back price should be and what the valuation around RIV would be. And so if the state elects to go RIK under the structure, taking away the valuation disputes is another factor that would make the equity participation attractive to the producers. Moving to the third criteria, which is preserving the value to the state from royalty and taxes, there's two principles that are sort of outlined here. The first is to To the extent that the state is providing an incentive to the project, is it possible for the state to achieve value in return for that incentive? And then the second is it possible to preserve the state's expected revenues from the project relative to a world without equity participation? And I'm going to walk through a few slides here that present our analysis of whether those two principles have been achieved.
Would you back up and restate those principles?
Sure. On slide 9 here for the record. The first is, to the extent that the state is providing incentives for this project, can the state achieve value in return for that incentive? So rather than just reducing royalty or production tax, if there's a transfer of value from the state side of the table to the producers, can the state get back something in return for that transfer of value? And it goes to the second bullet here, which is saying, can we preserve the revenues that the state would have gotten if we didn't have equity participation and we stayed in an SB 21 fiscal world for this project? Can we match the revenue stream that we would have gotten in that path? What we're showing on slide 10 is a forecast of the state's revenues from the Alaska LNG project under that modified status quo that I talked about, which essentially is simply SB 21 as it is today with a production credit for gas. And I want you to focus on the total cash flows at the bottom. Over this time period that we're looking at here, under the assumptions that are built in here, the state would have made about $70 billion from the Alaska LNG project. To the right of this chart, we're showing the breakup of that total cash flow, the total revenues to the state. And it's showing about 30% of royalty, about 40% production tax, and then the rest of it is made up of property tax and state corporate income tax. Next, when we go to slide 11, we model again what the state's revenues would be with equity participation. Now, one of the things you'll notice right away here is that you have that period of negative revenues or negative cash flows, and that's the equity participation. Pardon me. That's where the state's making an investment into the project. And then starting in 2024, once the project is operational, you start seeing cash flows associated with that. Again, if you go to the bottom line here, what you see is that the state makes, you know, about $72 billion with the equity participation over this time period that we're looking at. And so what that tells us is that at a 25% equity participation, which is what we've modeled here, the state's making about as much as you would have made without equity participation in the project. It's a little bit better in this case, and when we get to the next slide, I'll talk a little bit more about that. What does happen is that the makeup of those revenues changes. If you look on the right, your royalty value is preserved and, in fact, actually increases. Your property tax decreases, and that's because now 25% of the project does not pay property tax, because it's state-owned. But that gets compensated by what we're calling the project ownership of midstream revenues. It's the returns that you would earn from the investment in the midstream itself. And so while the makeup of the different components of the revenue change, overall, at a 25% participation in the project, the state is able to preserve the value that it would have earned without the equity participation. Please do stop me if we need to go over that again. I'm happy to. I know it's sort of a lot of information, and it's about to get a little bit more complicated here. What we're looking at on slide 12 is one of the big questions when you say, you know, here's an idea, participate with equity in the project, is how much equity, right? What is a good range for the state to start talking about equity participation in the project, where it makes sense for the producers and it makes sense for the state. And that's the question that we try to answer here. And one of the key things for us all to understand is that there are so many uncertainties associated with this project that it's hard to pin down one number and say, well, this is the number to beat, right? Because it's going to depend on the capital cost of the project. It's going to depend on the market prices. All of that will impact what royalty earnings the state would have had, what production tax earnings the state would have had. And so recognizing that there's all of that uncertainty, the objective really is to try and get to the ballpark. You know, is it in the 20s? Is it in the teens? Is it 40%? How much equity do we need, and how much of the gas does the state need to have an arrangement with the producers where we're not losing value? And so what 12 looks at are different scenarios of capital costs for the project as well as market prices. And under each of those scenarios, it is trying to solve for what is the equity participation level where the revenues we would have made without equity participation, just staying with SB 21, would match the revenues that the state would make with equity participation. And so if you look at the number at the very center of this graph, which is the 24%, in the previous slide here, we're assuming a 25% equity participation, and you'll see that the number at the bottom is just a little bit better than the status quo number, which was the $68 billion in the previous slide. If we had modeled a 24% equity participation, those two should essentially have been equal. And so that's what the numbers on slide 12 mean. It's what is that number of, you know, the percentage of equity where the status quo world as well as your revenues from the equity participation world are equal. And the bottom line here is that somewhere in that 20 to 30% seems like the right ballpark to for the state to participate with equity in the project. At a low price scenario, which is you know a high risk case for the state, if you have 20, you know, somewhere in the 20s equity participation, the state is getting a higher share of the gas than it would have needed to match its revenues under an SB 21 world. And so you've improved your position in that very risky scenario for the state. At a high price, everyone's making money anyway. And so even if you didn't match what you would have made at SB 21 at 25%, you're still making a lot of money. That's, you know, in some ways a good problem to have at that point. And so what you really want to plan around are your low price and base prices and make sure that in that world, we haven't lost revenues to the state from the level of equity participation that we've undertaken. And that takes us to the next concept that I want to highlight here on 13, which is that the level of equity participation is going to be determined by the gross tax that this legislature will decide on. Because your royalty is somewhat fixed, right? It's at or around 13%. And because your share of the gas is equal to the share of equity, the variable there is how much tax gas do you take. So if royalty is at 13, then depending on these different levels of tax gas that we've shown here, that gets you to a 20% or a 22% or a 25% share of equity in the project. So if we want a 25% equity share in the project, that means your gross gas share has to be 14%. And that plays through here all the way to the boxes on the very right, you know, and that's going to drive how much investment the state's going to have to make in the project as well. Recognizing that as you take on a greater equity share, the investment requirement from the state is going to go up as well. Moving on to the next recommendation and objective, which is manage your risks, right? The first risk that I want to highlight here is price exposure. We pointed this out in the royalty study. Price is by far, you know, there are lots of distant seconds, but price is by far the first and biggest risk factor to this project. It's a huge driver of the revenues that the project will make. And so what this is showing is, again, those same different levels of market variables and uncertainties. We're looking at capital costs, a range of capital costs, as well as a range of prices, and trying to understand under each of these what the total cash flows to the state would be. Okay, and I want to point out here a couple of things. Let's look at the set of results on the far left that all correspond to a low price environment. And what we'll see there is that the green bars, which all represent a world where the state has equity participation in the project, are all higher than the blue bars. And what that's simply saying is that under no price environment, the state would earn more with equity participation than it would have earned without the equity participation. And so equity participation dampens the state's risk exposure under a low price environment. The flip side of that are the set of bars to the very right. And you'll notice there that the green bars are all lower than the blue bars. And what that's saying is, under a high price environment, the state's revenues are going to be lower than what you would have without the equity participation. So you're losing some of the upside as well. In general, what the equity participation is doing is that it's flattening the state's revenue profile, its exposure to these different market environments. And that is driven by the fact that part of the state's revenues are going to be dependent on, are earned from the midstream and your return on that investment. And those are not price sensitive. And so because you've introduced that component of revenues to the state that don't fluctuate with prices, it helps to flatten your profile. The next risk exposure is that of capital costs and cost overruns. And they are a very, very real risk for this project as well. Almost all of the projects that have that have achieved FID and are currently under construction are all going over their budget. It's because there's significant competition for resources, and it's pushing up your labor costs, it's pushing up your material costs. I mean, and some of these projects are managed by, you know, some of the best companies in the world, but it's just the market changing. And we do expect that, given the scale of the Alaska project, that cost overruns can be a very real risk here. What we're looking at is, and from the state's perspective, the highest risk exposure is prior to the project start. That's when there are cash calls.
I thought I misheard you, and then I heard what you said. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. Prior to project start, when there are cash calls on the state, that is the biggest exposure that the state has. Because once the project is in operation, there are going to be revenues that are coming that will support any cost that the project has. But the initial period, especially during that construction period that we talked about, where you're spending 95% of the project's costs, when there are cost overruns, the state is essentially exposed 100% to absorbing those. The participation by TransCanada that's envisioned by the administration allows the state to offset some of those capital cost exposures up front to TransCanada. The assuming that TransCanada takes the state's equity position in the GTP as well as the pipeline, or 60% of the state's equity in the GTP and the pipeline, and the state retains the rest of it as well as the LNG plant, what that works out to is that the state can still keep 20 to 25% of the gas share, but only be responsible for between 13 and 18% of the project's costs, the upfront costs, because TC is going to bear the remaining costs. And this becomes, you know, needless to say, even more important when you have cost overruns, because those are percentages of a bigger number. And just to put numbers in context, if we move to slide 16, that shows what the state's total investment in the project would be if it went alone, which is the blue line, or if it was in the deal with TransCanada in the picture. On the left here, we're showing sort of the midway estimate for this project at $45 billion. And at that level, having TransCanada as part of the deal reduces the state's upfront cash investment by about $3 billion. When you move to the lines on the right of the graph, which is assuming a cost overrun, and you get to a $54 billion project, you've had a 20% cost overrun, then that reduces the state's cash call, so the investment that the state would be making toward the project, by $4 billion, having TC in the mix. And so it's material, the impact that having TC in the picture can have in reducing just the raw exposure that the state would have before we have an operational project. Moving on to slide 17, the third risk that we're talking about here is the potential loss of value through moving to royalty in kind. And this is something that the royalty study dealt with in a lot of detail. But the bottom line of the highlighted risk was that if the state goes royalty in kind, and the state is now, you know, Alaska LNG Marketing Co. trying to market this LNG in the global market, it is going to likely suffer a loss of value because, one, the state does not have any expertise in marketing global, you know, LNG to the global market, and two, you're competing with some of the best companies in the world that do this for a living. If the state had state royalty in value, then those best companies in the world would be marketing that gas for you, essentially, and giving you a portion of the value that they achieve. But moving to royalty in kind takes away that advantage and exposes the state, and could expose the state pretty meaningfully to an erosion in the price negotiated. The HOA includes some intent from the producers where they offer to negotiate individually with the state to market the state's share of the gas. And the state is only obligated to elect RIK if the state feels like satisfactory arrangement, I'm quoting from the HOA here, satisfactory arrangements for the disposition of the state's share of LNG has been made. Having the producers market the state's share of the gas would be beneficial and could recreate the marketing benefit that royalty, that staying in royalty and value could have. Because conceptually, the state's share of the LNG will be bundled along with the producer's LNG and all marketed together. And so the state would achieve the benefits of their marketing expertise and their negotiation. So if that is resolved, if that negotiation between the producer and the state is resolved to where the state's happy with the terms of that arrangement, it could be a very effective way for the state to mitigate the risk of being exposed on the global LNG market alone with LNG to sell. And then moving to slide 18, one entire area of risks that were highlighted in the royalty study were that the devil's in the details. In principle, or in theory, it sounds like a good idea to have equity participation. Everyone has an equal share of the gas, equal share of equity, and away we go. We're all lined up. But the details of the terms that are included there could really either help the state achieve its various objectives or not. Objectives like enabling access, enabling the project to be expanded, having access to information. And so the HOA does include different elements that start saying the right things about how you achieve all of those objectives. It contemplates a framework of a project within a project, where essentially the state's share of the project, you could almost theoretically think of that as a separate project by itself. The state will, through its negotiations with TransCanada, set its own tariff for that part of the project. The state can expand its part of the project. The expansion principles, that the pro-expansion principles that have been included in the HOA, essentially say that any party can expand the project as long as it's not to the detriment of what the other parties achieve from the project. In other words, the combination of the state and TransCanada can solicit an expansion in the project, and unless the other parties can prove that it's somehow operationally or otherwise affecting their operations, they have to agree to that expansion. And so if you have an Anadarko or some other company in the future that has discoveries and wants to be able to monetize that gas, it creates an avenue for the state to be able to facilitate that. The state entity that would be the holder of the equity in the project would have access to the information, the same information that the producers would have access to. And the concept of having, again, stage-gated commitments where the state is only committing at each stage to, you start with a small commitment and then it goes to a bigger commitment and a bigger commitment. As each party gets access to more information about the project and as you increase the certainty around the capital cost of the project, around the market that's out there for the project, it's a very prudent approach to project development. It's what you would see anywhere in the world. You're not making a one-time commitment on, these are all the dollars that we will commit to this project and this is how the fiscals will be laid out. We're not quite making all of those commitments up front. What the HOA leads the state to is, can we get through pre-FEED together and find out more about the project?
Senator Dunleavy?
That's true. I mean, obviously it's true. When you look at page 4, you're committing capital at various steps.
At the first step, you're committing the capital, first part of the capital.
Right. Yeah. And if you want to get out of it, you commit a capital. That capital's gone.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair. Yes.
Then you go to the second step, and you're committing capital.
Correct.
So yes, you're not committing all of it up front, but each step costs money to keep going.
That's correct, and it's consistent with how these large projects are developed, and it's part of what makes the state's participation attractive to the producers is everyone has money, skin in the game. Everyone has money on the table proportionately. And the other thing, and Larry alluded to this as well, is that it's quite significant that the producers are in the mix here. And they are, depending on what the state's equity share is, going to be putting up 75% to 80% of this project's cost through each stage of the process as well. So that is definitely a positive sign, and the market sees it like that. I will say here that, all of these elements that the HOA lay out are, what I would think of as principles. The details need to get worked out as we get to the commercial agreements that are ahead for the state. And so this is a work in progress, as it's normal for it to be a work in progress at this stage of the project. But it's something that needs to actively be managed between now and when these commercial arrangements are made, that all of these principles and the objectives that the state has from the project actually come through in the commercial agreements that are ahead.
Senator Dunleavy?
Mr. Chair, just a clarification. We're looking at four partners or five? In other words, is TransCanada and the state sharing a singular partnership? In other words, there's a we have BP.
We're partners.
Name the partners.
So you have the parties to the HOA are the three producers, the state, AGDC, as well as TransCanada. And I'll stop your intern here and see if that's correct. Yes.
Say that again one more time, please.
The three producers, so it's Exxon, BP, right. And Conoco.
Right.
AGDC.
Four.
The state, represented by DNR and DOR, and TransCanada.
So there's six separate partners in this arrangement. Okay, thank you.
Is that a correct way to characterize that? I thought it was the three producers plus the state and the state AGDC and TransCanada as a partner. What's a partnership within a partnership?
The six parties that I mentioned are all the signatories to the HOA, and they're all the different parties at the table in some sense. The specific arrangement would be for each of the producers to have, you know, their own share through the project of the gas as well as the midstream, for the state to have its share through the midstream, through AGDC, you know, as it's envisioned now, and for TransCanada to participate through the state's equity participation in the project. And so the state would bequeath to TransCanada a portion of its equity in the GTP as well as pipeline.
Senator Bishop?
Might be a play on words, but I like joint venture between TransCanada and the state. Would that be accurate, too?
Senator Bishop, through the chair. I don't want to misrepresent the legalese, because I know there's a number of different arrangements that are being contemplated here. I will defer to either the state's legal team or the administration to, you know, characterize the arrangements.
Senator Dunleavy, I'm having a hard time saying
your participants. There's four participants, but possibly six entities.
I think that's a good characterization.
All right, go ahead. Senator Faircliff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to go back. You used the word bequeath, and that sounds like a gift. So could you please expand on that or elaborate?
Okay. Senator Faircliff, through the chair. Thank you for asking that question, because as I said it, I was like, maybe that was not the right word. What the state will be doing in its arrangement with TransCanada is assigning a portion of the equity, of its share of the equity, to TransCanada. And, you know, there's different aspects of that transaction where TransCanada will pay the upfront costs associated with its portion, and the state enters into a commercial arrangement with TransCanada to pay TransCanada a tariff through the GTPN pipeline. I do want to say that we're coming back on Friday and going to delve deeper into that specific transaction with TransCanada, and so I'll be able to walk you through then, much more detail on that.
Thank you, and I certainly can hold until that point, but I'd like you to make sure that when we talk about that, we talk about whether there's value to the state of Alaska for that assignment of shares to TransCanada, and I am hopeful that that's part of that conversation.
Yes, it will be. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So slide 19, we're essentially summarizing, you know, sort of the scorecard for the HOA. We have the different recommendations and objectives that the royalty study laid out been met, or how the HOA addresses those. Alignment through equity, again, to summarize, the equity participation along the entire supply chain is positive to achieve alignment. And taking your royalty and tax as a share of the gas, again, creates a situation where each party has an equivalent part of the gas as well as equivalent share in the project. improving commercial attractiveness, we looked at the producer IRR, as you may recall, and, you know, the arrangement improves the producer returns from the project and potentially reduces their risk because the state is now sharing some of that. While improving the commercial attractiveness and attractiveness of this project for the producers, the arrangement, you know, could preserve value for the state as well. And I use the word could there because it depends on what the final equity share would be, right? And recognizing that what we're trying to do with that equity share is to get to the right ballpark. And regarding each of the risks that were highlighted as we walked through these, equity participation does help to dampen the exposure that the state has to prices from the project. And, you know, we talked about how having those midstream earnings makes a portion of the state's revenues, not fluctuate with prices and helps to flatten the state's revenue profile. TC's participation lowers the state's cash calls in the years prior to commercial operation, and that's one of the ways that the capital cost exposure has been reduced. With the producer offer to negotiate to market the state's share of the gas, the exposure to the state marketing its own gas under RIK has been contemplated here. And the structure of the participation, again here, the project within a project, having stage-gated commitments, so we're not making one big commitment up front, having pro-expansion principles where each party can expand the project if it wants to, and securing access to information. I would characterize, you know, the colors towards the right of this graph are trying to get to what's the level to which these objectives have been achieved in the HOA. And structurally, the alignment and helping to improve the commercial attractiveness by reducing the producer's upfront cost and preserving value to the state, the HOA, I would say, has been fairly successful at moving in the right direction towards achieving those objectives. With the managing risks, you know, there's elements of the HOA that are trying to get there, and they will remain a work in progress. And it's given where the project is right now, you cannot completely mitigate those risks. But there are elements in the HOA that start laying out the principles towards where the state can manage those risks. And it's something that this body, as well as the administration, you know, should keep your eyes on. In how the actual commercial arrangements will play out to be able to achieve all of the state's objectives. With that, I conclude my testimony. I'll take more questions if we have any.
Thank you. It is almost exactly 7 o'clock. If we have some quick questions, let's do it. We have a lot of time in front of us to get into this fairly deeply. I wanted a general overview, which you've given us, and I appreciate it. It's very, very informative. Questions from the committee? And Mr. Destichter? Yeah, Mr. Destichter, did you have anything to add to this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jason Destichter with Black and Veatch for the record. I did not have anything to add. I am available here for questions of the more detailed nature, if need be.
All right, then, without any questions, thank you so much for your presentation. I certainly appreciate it. Tomorrow morning, I believe, do we have it tomorrow morning?
Yeah.
9 o'clock, normal 9 o'clock meeting, and I don't have a list of what's up. And then we'll do another meeting tomorrow night, and we will be, stand by just a moment. I'll tell you tomorrow at the finance meeting in the morning what we're doing in the evening. Without any further comments, thank you and have a good night.